Morning, everybody. Welcome to the Workforce, Labor, Economic Development, Finance, and Policy meeting here today. We've got a full room today, so I really appreciate a lot of the participants being here today. Welcome, members. I apologize for getting started just a little bit late this morning. We had some serious printing issues this morning, so we don't have a bill in front of us, members. It's on its way en route, and I've talked to the lead Pinto to make sure that he was okay with us talking about this bill in efforts to make sure that our time is used wisely this morning. We'll also have research in front of us, too. So, again, technology kind of got in the way a little bit today. I apologize, members and audience. Those are on its way, and we can't move the bill until the bill is in front of us. So I just want to make sure everybody's aware of that. So my apologies for the short delay this morning. The plan today is just to talk about House File 11, which is the paid family medical bill pause, a one-year delay, and we're going to hear from a lot of people today. We have, is it this room reserved? This room will be reserved also for this evening. If we run into testimony and need more time to do this, we'll come back after the floor session tonight. We'll go into recess kind of at the call of the chair, but we do have this reserved for this evening as well. Today, Vice Chair Mecklen will kind of take over for me as I go to the testifier table to present the bill. Again, when we have a large audience, we just want to make sure that folks know that the decorum of the room is to try to, you know, no applauses, no moans, no groans. There's a lot of reasons to do that. We just make sure that in this room we keep those kind of outbursts sort of not allowed here. I just want to make sure we're set up for that. I think I've got everything else in place. And members, what we can do right now, because we do see a quorum, we can pass the minutes. Representative Pinto, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from yesterday, February 11th? And if it's okay, we'd like to have you move the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I had not, but I just did.
Okay.
And the minutes look good to me. And so I do move approval of the minutes subject to what we talked about before. I'm a non-voting member of the committee, and so I'm not, I think that I'm not actually allowed to make motions.
Well, then I can't
somebody
do this again with you, can I, Representative?
I don't think that you can, Mr. Chair.
Representative Berg, would you mind looking at the minutes and just making sure we have approval of the minutes on the minute?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had looked at the minutes, and I moved to approve them.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Any comments, further questions about the minutes as presented, members? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are carried. With that, I will head to the testifying table. Again, members and everybody else, we have paper on the way, so appreciate the ability to do that today. Be right back. Morning, Mr. Chair.
Morning, Representative Baker. Would you care to begin telling us about your bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, again, I just want to say thanks to everybody. Today we're going to be hearing House File 11. This has been basically a lot of work from a lot of people to just really take another look at House File 11. We heard yesterday that there was a lot of reasons why I feel the delay in this is important. I think we had a lot of uniquenesses with this bill. How it was built, how it was authored, how the fiscal notes were not a normal fiscal note process. It was very confusing. It was late delivered to us in last session. We have not had enough time to really look at both sides and how it affects everybody that will be deeply affected by the work that a lot of us have been working on is to provide medical and family protections for people around the state of Minnesota through a mandated payroll deduction. So again, this pause will just allow us to hear from more of this session. Members, I hope that we can have, again, very good questions. I'm hoping today that we can hear a lot of our testifiers, both for and against this idea, and I'm sure we'll take questions at the end, Mr. Chair, as to kind of how we'll do that. I I think I'm just going to keep my minutes real brief this morning because I want to hear from others. And I know that the members will have more time to ask questions when they're finished with testifying. So with that, Mr. Chair, let's go to testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Baker. We're going to start with Lauren with the Minnesota Chamber, and after that will be Andy Wilkie.
And that's great, Mr. Chair. If I could just say, and we'll have the testifiers kind of coming as rapidly as they can to keep this going. And I did want to also mention my conversation with Lead Pinto. This next step is going to be to Ways and Means. So we are going to make sure that this bill has another stop in another committee, as kind of requested by Representative Pinto.
I'm so at the desk.
Thank you.
So far.
What is that?
Lauren, if you're ready, please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I'm a policy director with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, a statewide organization representing over 6,300 businesses and 500,000 employees across the state. Thank you for the opportunity to share our members' support for House File 11, pausing the implementation of the Paid Family Medical Leave Program by 1 year. While, of course, we are fundamentally opposed to the idea of the state mandating an employer benefit and taking over the administration of it, programs that support this goal should have the dual effect of helping employees without creating an undue or uneven financial burden on employers. Balance is necessary to protect public interest and promote economic growth. In the last 2 years, roughly 35 new unbalanced mandates have been placed on business, burdening them with increased costs, operational and staffing challenges, additional unaccounted for paid time off and staff time, or the need to hire new staff entirely to spend on compliance. Looking ahead, the current paid family medical leave plan is also imbalanced, and at this juncture, from the perspective of large businesses already complying with other state or national programs to small businesses operating in our border communities, unworkable. As Minnesotans, we should all want state programs to operate and function as intended and within expected costs. Just look at UI, another billion-dollar program often praised by proponents of the mandate as being the model, where just yesterday in the Senate Jobs Committee, Deed presented on the fact that despite macroeconomic trends of low unemployment rates and decreasing experience rating, benefit payments and broad-based usage in UI is increasing dramatically, putting so much pressure on the UI Trust Fund that last year employers received a shocking UI payroll tax notice in late December indicating an immediate double-digit increase in base rates plus an additional 5% assessment. Just imagine the impact of this scenario playing out in the paid leave context, where the payroll tax rates are higher, the taxable wage rate is higher, benefit payouts will be larger, usage patterns will be larger, and qualifying conditions are more robust. Based on the discrepancies between fiscal note calculations and actuarial analysis of the structure of the program and an unrealistically condensed timeline for implementation, it appears Minnesota is at risk of launching an unsound program that will require taxpayers to stabilize and result in a negative experience for workers and employers alike. Numerous questions on the design, build-out, and integrity of this new system go unanswered, and answers to questions from employers about basic functionality and costs are not yet finalized or unknown. From our members' perspective, as entities that design, implement, and administer complicated benefits packages, we have offered numerous necessary adjustments to the program in order to ensure a more solvent, workable, and fair program that have gone unheeded to date. We have repeatedly asked legislators work to reduce confusion resulting from the interpretation of this new law since its enactment. In less than 1 year, the PFML mandate alone will impose a new nearly $2 billion tax on every one of Minnesota's workers and employers, while exacerbating staffing shortages and constraining operations and growth. Employees right now are not looking for their pay to be decreased due to these new higher payroll taxes. In fact, most have no idea that this program is even financed through their own earnings. Employers are anxious about how their employees will be handled by the state, and the economy is not looking for businesses to cut back on hiring, benefits, services, and expansion in Minnesota to accommodate the effects of this program. Our members continue to request reasonable limits on the scope of this mandate, realistic time frame for its implementation, and relief from the financial and operational impacts of it, We think House File 11 is a more realistic approach to implementing a mandate of this magnitude and look forward to working with you on additional policy changes with this in mind. Thank you for the opportunity to share this perspective with the committee.
Thank you. One quick thing, if we have everybody who's testifying, if you can try to keep it to 3 minutes, we're going to be timing this, so I forgot to mention it in the beginning. Andy, you may proceed.
Yes,
and the next after that will be John Besche.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andy Wilkie, Executive Vice President of Greater Mankato Growth, the Regional Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Organization, serving over 900 members in the Greater Mankato region. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Greater Mankato attracts a workforce from an area that includes 22 counties in southern Minnesota and northern Iowa. We are home to more than 25,000 college students and have the highest rate of retail spending per capita, more than any other Minnesota metro. Agriculture is a core part of our economy. We are the green seam. More soybeans are processed in Mankato than any other city in North America. To the proposal before us, all of our members sympathize with many of the goals of the paid family medical leave legislation. However, there have been more questions than answers, and the clock is ticking. Not only did this legislation create a new billion-dollar program that imposes a new tax on all employers and employees, but it also imposes a significant administrative burden on all employees, large and small, public and private, many of which are small business owners just trying to survive each day. Further, and most important, this law has already interfered with an employer's ability to tailor benefits that meet the unique needs of their workplace. This one-size-fits-all approach ignores the diverse needs of each employer across the state. A healthcare provider in Mankato, who's in the building today for Chiropractic Day, recently shared that while she sympathizes with the goals of this legislation, she has limited options to cover the cost at her practice. In the last 10 years, her reimbursement rates have remained flat. She has few options other than simply cutting costs elsewhere in the business. This may result in her allocating fewer resources for free support services for new mothers, babies, and families. Our members understand that their employees are the most valuable resource. They are doing everything they can to provide their employees with the benefits that they can afford. Minnesota has much to be proud of, but future success is not guaranteed. Adding burdens and barriers to employers will have negative unintended consequences on future growth. We urge you to support House File 11 and delay the implementation of this massive new program. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Before we go to John, Representative Baker, now that we have the bill in front of us, would you like to renew your motion?
I can do that, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, and thank you, Ann, for coming in. I know that the printer was a problem this morning. So, members, in front of you is House File 11. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move my bill. Thank you.
Sorry, so moved. John, if you'd like to proceed, please do.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Mecklen, Lead Pinto, members of the committee. My name is John Besche, and I'm the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments in support of House File 11. NFIB represents over 10,000 small and independently owned businesses that are located in every corner of Minnesota. Our mission is to provide and protect the rights, to promote and protect the rights of our members to own, operate, and grow their businesses. NFIB was strongly opposed to the passage of a state-run paid family and medical leave program because of the immense costs and operational burden that it will impose on small businesses. While we remain opposed to the underlying mandate, we strongly support House File 11, which would provide an additional year for employers to adjust financially, explore innovative solutions, and meaningfully engage with state-led education and other resources. The Paid Family Medical Leave Act is the largest mandate ever to be imposed on Minnesota's businesses, and it comes at a time when businesses are already struggling with workforce shortages, increased tax burdens, and compliance with new regulations from the last 2 years. Most small businesses lack an HR department or accountant, meaning that the owner is regularly involved in both the administration and operations of the business. This bill would provide additional time for businesses to adjust their payroll systems, staffing plans, and financial strategies to accommodate the requirements of the new program. Employers have been hit with numerous mandates over the past 2 years, and each new mandate has required them to dedicate time and resources towards ensuring proper compliance. This bill would allow for a lengthier period of outreach and education to ensure that employers thoroughly understand their rights and responsibilities under this program and to avoid unnecessary confusion. Finally, several states have faced challenges in rolling out similar programs, including technical issues during the application process and other delays. This bill will provide additional time to ensure that the state system to manage claims and facilitate contributions can be adequately tested and refined before going live and avoid a repeat of past technological failures. In closing, it is our view that an additional year will provide businesses with additional time to better prepare for compliance and adjust their operations to accommodate this costly mandate. We strongly encourage members of the committee to support House File 11, and thank you all again for the opportunity to share our comments today.
Thank you. And next we have Steve Barthel, and up after that will be Bruce Neustad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Bartle. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Grocers Association. The Grocers Association has been representing Minnesota's food industry for over 125 years. We're the only trade association in the state that advocates for the entire food industry from farm to fork. Our membership consists of over 300 member companies operating more than 1,300 locations throughout Minnesota and employ over 150,000 union and non-union workers. We understand the appeal of delaying the implementation of the paid leave program for 12 months and support the postponement to give legislators time to address the concerns you've heard raised today and during the past 2 years. However, we believe that simply pushing the rollout back 1 year will not solve the fundamental flaws with this program. Without addressing the underlying issues that make the program unsustainable, we are simply kicking this time bomb down the road. We want to be absolutely clear. As an industry that has consistently offered leave options for employees, we are not arguing against the obvious benefits that leave provides. To the contrary, our members are concerned that this one-size-fits-all program will result in a lower quality leave product than most already offer to their workforce, and it will come at a substantially higher price tag. The current benefit set of the paid leave program is misaligned with its tax structure. The number of weeks benefits can be taken and the scope of usage exceed what the tax rate can sustain. No other state with paid leave laws include every business, no matter its size, with such a long of duration of leave. Additionally, adding confusion to our heavily unionized industry, the paid leave law is not clear as to how the new law requirements interact with collective bargaining agreements. We contacted the paid leave department for clarification, but they have been either unwilling or unable to provide a clear answer regarding how paid leave affects these agreements. This just scratches the surface of the challenges that this program will face unless these issues are addressed before it launches, whether that's January 1st, 2026 or January 1st, 2027. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to express our support for delaying the implementation of the paid leave program. However, we urge the committee to make practical changes to address the program's clear flaws. Thank you.
Thank you. And next we will have Bruce Neustad, and after that will be Hannah Zinn. You may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mecklen, Lead Pinto, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Neustad with the Minnesota Retailers. We represent about 1,200 retail storefronts statewide. Our members range from family-owned retail businesses on Main Street to regional and national retailers. I'm here today to support Chair Baker's House File 11 and the delayed implementation of the Paid Family Medical Leave Program by 1 year. We believe, quite frankly, that there's a large number of businesses, simply put, that just aren't ready to comply with the Act on January 1, 2026. For many employers, as you've heard, and I think Mr. Vesci commented well, and especially small businesses, there's some significant uncertainty about the law and lack of awareness. And for those small businesses where the owner is also the HR manager and the legal compliance person, this program will come as a surprise, as it's not uncommon for that person, as you heard, to be managing payroll, taking care of customers, managing compliance, as well as daily operations. And for those retailers that are aware of the law, the complexity, as you just heard, of the program really creates more questions at this point than it does answers. For retailers specifically, we have some deep concerns around seasonal workers and how they'll be treated under the bill and how that language fell. And we think of that in terms of seniors and college students that are working over a summer season, then over a holiday season as well, and reaching a mandate that allows a benefit that will be confusing and actually be a disincentive for the retailer to employ people in those seasonal type jobs. We're really concerned about the consequences of moving too fast and too quickly without adequate guidance for support for implementation, and really delaying the program by 1 year would provide some much-needed time for businesses to prepare, for regulators to refine their guidance, and for lawmakers to consider necessary adjustments this session and next, especially for small businesses. I'll end just with a quick story, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Along with a colleague, I was before a group of about 80 small retailers last week. Now, none of those retailers were my members, and I don't think they were a member of any chamber of commerce. It was sort of a group that meets occasionally, and it's safe to say that virtually none of those 80 retailers knew anything about this program or had thought about it. So it concerns us that about 10 and a half months from now, small businesses like that will be dealing with a fairly large program that will have a significant impact on their operations as well as their workforce without much awareness. So we think there's a great opportunity to pause the program for a year and really make sure all the ducks are in row. And really today we're just asking for that time to get the program right. A delay really would help ensure retailers comply effectively, continue serving their communities, and provide great jobs without unnecessary disruption. So we urge support for this delay and continued conversation around. We thank Chair Baker for the bill.
Thank you, Bruce. Next we will have Hannah, and then after that will be Gavin Hansen. And Hannah, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chair Meckland and committee members. My name is Hannah Zinn, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for Hospitality Minnesota, which is the state's restaurant and food service, hotels and lodging, resorts and campground sectors, and more. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 11, Minnesota paid leave law implementation being delayed by 1 year. In Minnesota, the hospitality industry makes up over 384,000 jobs, which averages out to about 12% of the state's total workforce. Our members make up businesses of varying sizes, business models, and economic impact. The industry contributes $2.3 billion in annual tax revenue to the state and more than $8.1 billion in total labor income. While we believe the goal of providing the best possible benefits to all workers, including paid family medical leave, is laudable, this program's complicated structure and unclear guidance mean our small business operators across Minnesota need more time to understand and implement the program. We believe that allowing businesses to have an additional year to adjust to these new benefit requirements will allow for greater transparency between employers and employees. The hospitality industry is made up of varying business models, from hotels and resorts to small family-owned inns to the bars and restaurants so many of us enjoy. These businesses operate differently than traditional businesses, with employers and employees often working alongside each other every single day. The notice of intent to take leave is critical to the hospitality industry. Customary practice in the industry is employees relying on each other to trade shifts when an illness or emergency comes up. But with no clear guidance in these rules, employers worry an already tight labor market will create more chaos. We hope this additional delay will allow more thoughtful and meaningful discussion to take place between industry, policymakers, and department leaders to create rules and a structure of benefits that works for everyone. Thank you for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Hannah. Gavin, you'll be next. After Gavin Hansen, it'll be Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members of the committee. My name is Gavin Hansen, and I serve as the Fiscal and Economic Policy Director for the Minnesota Business Partnership. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House File 11. I will be focusing my comments primarily on the functionality of the system itself. Ensuring that a program as vital as paid family medical leave functions seamlessly from day one should not be a political issue. It is a reasonable expectation that Minnesotans will have when this law takes effect on January 1st. For thousands of employees working for some of Minnesota's most iconic companies, this is an expectation deeply ingrained. They have long received some of the most generous paid leave benefits in the country without delays, system crashes, or technical failures. Unfortunately, at this moment, we cannot confidently say that the same level of certainty and reliability will be met when the state-run program launches. I have no doubt that the staff at the paid leave department within Deed are working diligently. However, no guardrails have been put in place to ensure a smooth rollout, particularly with regard to software functionality and system capacity. There are legislative fixes to this program that still need to be addressed, but today is not about those. Today is about making sure the department has the time necessary to ensure that this program works. The Minnesota Business Partnership supports giving the department more time to ensure that when this program does launch, it does so without failure. The last thing Minnesotans want is a repeat of Minshew debacle of 2014, when a failed $100 million IT system left Minnesotans frustrated and unserved. With that in mind, MBP strongly urges the following steps before launch. Number one, conduct an independent audit of the paid leave department and program to determine whether key implementation benchmarks have been met. This could be done by the legislative auditor or a third-party auditor, a prudent and harmless step that could prevent major failures. Number two, thoroughly test and audit the technology before launch. Minshew failed because technology testing was inadequate. A third-party IT audit is not only pragmatic, it's necessary. Number three, run an extensive beta test with state employees before full implementation. This will help identify remaining technical and customer service challenges, allowing for adjustments before Minnesotans rely on the system. These practical and proactive measures must be completed before Minnesotans make this enormous shift to a state-run paid leave program and away from long-standing, generous, and effective programs offered by Minnesota companies. These actions will take time but are necessary. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Gavin. Next will be Kim Lewis, and then John Hivala will be up next.
Go ahead, Kim.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Chair Baker, and members of the committee. My name is Kim Lewis, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, which is comprised of 331 school districts across Minnesota. Today, I'm also speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. We are speaking in support of House File 11 today. Together, our organizations are responsible for the administration and fiscal oversight of all school districts in Minnesota. I'd like to begin by emphasizing that our organizations recognize the valuable benefits that paid leave will bring to the workforce. In fact, our school districts, as employers, already negotiate these benefits with our teachers and staff through local collective bargaining agreements. As we've testified previously, our largest concern with paid leave is the cost. School districts receive all of our revenue from state and federal governments and through local taxes. Unlike businesses, we cannot increase prices to cover new or increased costs. As the law stands, the cost to provide paid leave is an unfunded mandate for school districts. A significant number of the 331 districts are currently making staffing cuts to balance budgets. No one wants to do that, but the increased costs and the increased needs are reality. Our biggest issue and question is, how do we pay for the paid leave benefit? Anoka-Hennepin, the state's largest school district, is cutting $20 million from their budget. Paid leave at its current rate of 0.88 would cost them approximately $2.5 million. Rosemont-Apple Valley-Eagan, which is the third largest school district in the state, it would cost them approximately $2.7 million. Our districts locally collectively bargain for salary and benefits. The paid leave law says employers were responsible for 50% of the payroll tax. The delay of the implementation of paid leave would allow our groups to better understand the new tax and to allow districts more time to manage the budget and moving forward. Our districts are compliant by nature. They want to abide by the law. However, they're struggling right now to ensure compliance and act in a fiscally sound manner. Additional time provides that opportunity to better understand the financial implications and resources and ensure systems are in place to execute and comply with fidelity. We want to thank you for the opportunity to weigh in on House File 11 today, and I'll be happy to stand for any questions later.
Thank you. Next we will have John, and after that will be Steve Gilbertson.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Hevela. I am the Chief People Officer at WESCOM. I'm here today representing WESCOM and Minshew. WESCOM is a 100% employee-owned company doing electrical and automation work in Duluth, Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning. Firstly, let me emphasize that our business supports the principle of paid leave. We understand the importance of providing employees with the time they need to care for their health and their families. I'm sure you're all aware that there's a labor shortage in this country, especially when it comes to the blue-collar world and skilled trades. If we don't do a great job of taking care of our employee owners, we won't be in business. We believe delaying the implementation of this law is crucial for several reasons. Number one, preparation time for business. Implementing a complex, comprehensive paid leave program requires significant adjustments in operational and financial planning. Number two, there's economic impacts. When employee policies are introduced, the employees end up paying a cost for this. Mandates for businesses to comply with take from the same revenue as wages do, making less available to reward the employees who are doing the work. Number three, administrative readiness. The state needs adequate time to establish the necessary infrastructure to manage the paid leave program effectively. In conclusion, we believe that a one-year delay in its implementation is necessary to ensure that businesses can adapt effectively, the state can establish a robust administrative system, and employees can continue to receive the benefits they deserve. I want to leave you with an example of one of the many challenges we'll face. We're an electrical company, so the state requires us to have a certain ratio of journeymen to apprentices. For every one journeyman we have, we can have two apprentices working with them. If a journeyman electrician has a child and decides to take 12 weeks off, we legally cannot have the apprentices work by themselves. Now we've lost three people for 12 weeks. Meanwhile, the important work being done by these three Minnesotans will not get done. There are also second and third order effects that we are unable to complete projects on time. Ships can't move, solar energy can't be generated, factories may have to idle, which affects many more people. And this isn't a hypothetical situation. I spent Christmas in the state of Washington, which has implemented paid family leave, and had the opportunity to visit with some businesses, and these are the real challenges we'll have to navigate. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, John. Next, we'll have Steve, and then we'll go back. I actually skipped one. I apologize. Justin Turch, State Director, will lead after.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair and committee members. My name is Justin Turch. I'm the State Director of the Minnesota Society of HR Management, and we have about 6,000 dues-paying members throughout Minnesota. But my real paid job is being an HR consultant in Duluth, and my office is in Representative Johnson's district, and thank you for your service and public safety, Representative. to be clear, the HR Association of Minnesota is not pro-employer, and we are not pro-employee. We are pro-employment. And we believe strongly that every Minnesotan deserves meaningful work, and every organization in our state deserves an equipped workforce. And that's what we're here to advocate for today. I'm here to support, of course, House File 11, but from the perspective of an HR professional. While we strive to stay current with changing laws and regulations, as we've seen with the Earned Sick and Safe Time, employment law can be very complex, confusing, and challenging for many organizations, especially those that don't have the benefit of somebody like me and their team, which is most Minnesota employers. It's critically important to educate and engage in dialogue with both employees and employers to ensure everyone understands the program's benefits and costs. For example, Minnesota's broader approach to paid leave law is going to affect employers mainly who were not subject to federal FMLA. Businesses with fewer employees will find themselves in uncharted territory as they have to comply with a set of regulations that they've never seen before. This raises concerns because FMLA is one of the highest litigated laws in our country, and employers will have increased insurance premiums with their employment practices insurance and increased administrative duties to ensure that they're following the intricate laws set forth in Minnesota, which are more complex than those at the federal level. Another challenge we foresee is the need for more people like me that companies have to pay for, more HR people with more experience that cost more money in order to comply with these laws. Alternatively, it's diverting funds from activities that support employees to compliance. Finally, I'd remind the committee that in small organizations, the work will most often be left to other employees, most of whom are the people these laws are meant to protect, low-wage workers who are single parents, who work multiple jobs, and are going to be forced to work overtime to cover these absences of their coworkers. I think of the Rustic Inn Cafe, which is located on the North Shore, north of Two Harbors, Minnesota, with about 20 employees. I don't know if any of you have tried to use a temp agency lately, but you'll find that there's not a whole lot of temp employees. And it can be 3 to 4 months before you find a temp employee to do even the most basic tasks. With our employment rate, as we are blessed with, to be quite low, That has the additional challenge of not having staff that can just show up and cover a shift. It just doesn't work that way. A one-year delay would provide an opportunity, if nothing else, to prepare companies and staff to effectively comply with this law and work more closely with HR professionals, their lawyers, and, of course, the Department of Labor to do a good job in that compliance. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them either now or later after the hearing.
Thank you. And next will be Steve. And if you could identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Steve Gilbertson. I'm the owner of Electromatic. I've been running the company since 1997. We're located in Northeast Minneapolis, and we employ approximately 120 full-time employees. I'm here to show my support for House File 11, which would push back this mandate by 1 year. I'd like to start by providing just a brief history of the challenges our business has faced, as well as some of the ongoing struggles that we deal with that make this mandate more difficult for us. The events of 9/11 cut our workforce by 45% and took us 18 months to recover from. The events of 2008 with the housing market crash cut our workforce by 40% and took us 3 years to recover from. These two events don't even come close to comparing with the event of COVID pandemic in 2020. We have not recovered 4 years later. Our sales and our workforce were cut between 40 and 50%. We posted losses in 2020, 21, and 22. There seems to be a misconception with legislation that equates the number of employees to profitability in your ability to pay for something. That just simply isn't the case. In addition, our workforce has had been significantly impacted. Turnover is very costly in terms of training, quality, productivity, and efficiency. The supply chain has serious issues both with materials and labor constraints, which lead to delays in manufacturing. We've lost sales because of that. Our customers have looked for alternate sources because of that. We've experienced record inflation, which has impacted our raw material by 24% and continues to increase our cost of labor. Our property taxes last year were raised 21% with a proposal of 10% again this year. Our health insurance now is the second largest cost we have behind our payroll. We find it difficult to compete with Wisconsin, Iowa, North and South Dakota, and I have competitors in each of those states. Our price increases are met with fierce opposition from our customers. Often they're looking to cost down the products they buy from us, and often when we can't cost them down, they move those products to other manufacturers, either in other states, sometimes low-cost countries. Minnesota is in the top three or four states being the most costly to operate in. Many business owners that I associate with and talk to have a significant concern for the state of their business. This paid medical leave payroll tax is kind of a one-size-fits-all and will just fuel the fire that we're currently dealing with. This should absolutely be postponed until 2027, providing more time for businesses to figure out how they're going to deal with this and recover from the cost of the effects of COVID. This would also give the legislature additional time to go in and look at more affordable and more efficient ways to manage this. I remind you that these type of cost increases are not borne by the companies. These are always passed on. These are always passed on, right?
Thank you.
The cost simply gets passed on through higher prices, and business will automate, reduce workforce, cut services, relocate, or they'll fail. I thank you for the opportunity to support this File 11. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And next we'll have Jeremy Schmidt and Ms. Lorenz will be attending. And after that will be Aaron Dittmer Thompson. If you can identify yourself and proceed.
Start whenever you're ready. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Schmidt. I'm the superintendent of Becker Public Schools. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today with you about Paid Family Medical Leave Act, which has the potential to critically impact schools and communities. My goal today is to provide insight into the challenges this policy presents, offer practical recommendations for improving its implementation, and express my support for House File 11 to delay implementation by 1 year. Let me begin by saying that the Paid Family Medical Leave Act has some very good intentions and benefits, as noted in testimony and the support letters that I've seen online. However, its implementation raises critical questions about financial sustainability, operational feasibility, and unintended consequences for public schools. I recommend that the state develop clear guidelines to harmonize paid family leave with existing policies. Financial support or exemptions for districts should also be considered to avoid undue strain on our budgets. Public employers like schools and other government entities, it's essential for implementation to align with the start of our fiscal year, so I also recommend a July 1 implementation for those organizations. This would provide school districts with the necessary time to plan for funding and policy adjustments rather than forcing a mid-year financial reallocations that could negatively impact our students and staff. The financial impact of this mandate is also a serious concern. Paid family medical leave is expected to cost our district approximately $150,000 per year, and then with a January 1, 2026 implementation date, it would cost us $75,000 of that. This is equivalent to multiple teachers on our staff. Given our current flexible time off system, wouldn't these funds be better spent on educating our students and directly supporting them? Another concern is how this policy interacts with employers and employees who hold multiple jobs. If an individual qualifies for leave from a public school district but also works another job, does that mean they receive paid benefits for the school position while continuing to earn income elsewhere? This creates a fairness issue and an administrative burden that must be addressed before implementation. Schools already provide flexible employment opportunities for individuals who need flexibility. We have substitute positions for that purpose. And this allows greater control over schedules, and meaning a separate paid leave program may not be necessary for these roles. It's unclear how this program would interact with substitute teachers or other intermittent and seasonal employees. Similarly, we must consider how this program will apply to those receiving unemployment benefits, and Ms. Lorenz will speak more to that. Given the complexity of employment arrangements and existing benefits in public education, a one-size-fits-all approach simply does not work. I urge the legislature to use carve-outs for employers like schools that already provide substantial leave programs and flexibility, allowing them to continue managing their leave structures without unnecessary disruption. This would ensure that the policy supports those who need it most without penalizing those who have developed strong employee support systems. In closing, the intent behind paid family medical leave is commendable. Its broad application does present significant financial and operational challenges for public employers, particularly schools. Without adjustments, this policy risks creating administrative burdens, disrupting existing benefits, and introducing complexities that are difficult to navigate. I strongly urge the legislature to consider delaying implementation for schools and government entities until the start of their fiscal year, ensuring that districts have the time to prepare for this. Additionally, more clarity is needed on how the policy will interact with employees who hold multiple jobs, work as substitutes, or receive unemployment benefits. A more tailored approach is necessary for paid family medical leave to serve its intended purpose without creating undue financial or administrative strain. The complexities of different employee types, full-time, part-time, seasonal, substitutes, must be accounted for to prevent disruptions in staffing and budget allocations. By implementing a phased, flexible model that's fully funded by the state, we can protect employees while maintaining the stability and efficiency of our school systems.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm Jennifer Lorenz, and I'm the HR director for Becker Public Schools. As noted in past testimonies regarding some of these leave laws that are being rolled out and the frustrations and hardships that it's causing us on an everyday basis, I am feeling the same types of fears that did become reality when ESST was implemented. I hope that today I'm going to provide you some daily struggles that I am foreseeing coming down the pike with this new law, and I hope that we can extend this until you are able to provide us answers on how this is going to be implemented, what our expectations are at the ground level. So the first concern that I have is the impact on accumulated leave and our sick leave banks. Our teachers have on average 63 days of sick time accumulated. Over almost half of them have 100 or more days accumulated. So what's happening with those days? They're not going to be able to use those days. They have worked 20, 30 years in our district to build up these banks.
There's also the option to have a sick leave bank as a whole teacher bargaining unit where they have additional paid leave. What is going to happen to that? They're not going to give up those days freely. Are we going to have to negotiate that? Is the state going to be paying them out for those days? That's going to be a real concern and frustration for these employees that have worked and been at work and saved these days for this exact reason. And also, going forward, when we're negotiating future contracts, is there going to be requirements from the state coming down saying that we need to get rid of these sick leave banks and the amount of time that we're giving them through their negotiated bargaining agreements, because they will not be able to use that many days? Number two, the financial and administrative burdens. There are so many unanswered questions, just as there was with Earn Sick and Safe Time. I just want to give you an example of what I'm envisioning this looking like. So I have an employee who submits PFMLA requests to the state. The state then is going to have to come back to the employer to figure out how much their salary is. So we are going to have to communicate that back. Once they get that information, they're going to have to do this confusing calculation from what it sounds like, because it's not going to be the same for everybody. The more you make, the less amount you're going to get reimbursed. So once they figure out that calculation, they now have to bring that back to the employer to tell us how much they paid the employee, for what dates they paid the employee, because the employer is expected to supplement any underpayment with their sick leave balance. So I'm just wondering what that timeline looks like, and how is this person getting paid during this time? Are we paying them, and then we have to ask for reimbursement? There are just so many questions, and I've worked with the state before, and it is not a fast process. I think we can all admit that. The third thing is the double dipping or possibly triple dipping. All of our employees are paid year-round. They work 9 months, teachers, paras, food service, but now because of summer unemployment, they are all getting paid year-round. And I'm hearing that our 9-month employees can apply for PFMLA in the summer when they're not working. So I would like to know how that's going to work. Is the state going to be talking with the unemployment division and figuring out that they're paying them and they're paying them? And are we supposed to supplement them for
Ms. Lorenz, we need to keep moving. If you could wrap it up. Thank you.
I hope that this just shows you the daily struggles that I fear is coming at us, and we need answers before we can actually roll this out. So I thank you for your time. Sorry it was long-winded. But I just hope that we can put a hold on this until we have answers to all of these questions.
Thank you guys very
much.
Thank you. Thank you. Next we will have Aaron Dittmer-Thomas, and then after that we have we missed one earlier, so on the list. So Sarah Mullins will be after that. Thank you. If you'll identify yourself to the tape and proceed. No, we there was just one that was missing on the list that you'll be next.
Good morning.
Go ahead and have your race.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erin Thompson. I'm an English teacher at Egan High School and the mother of a 9-month-old daughter named Judy. I'm here this morning imploring you to not delay the implementation of Minnesota paid leave law. I had 10 days of paid maternity leave. When I began teaching 7 years ago, at 28 years old in Champaign, Illinois, a mentor teacher took me aside and asked if I was going to have kids. She told me, "Your sick days aren't sick days. That's your maternity leave. You can stay home sick when your kids are grown." So I saved my sick days. My husband, Nick, defended his dissertation and accepted a job in Minnesota. We packed up our house in Illinois, I applied for my Minnesota teacher's license, and I lost all those accumulated days in the move. Back to square one. When we decided to start our family, I had trouble conceiving. Anyone who struggled with infertility knows that means a lot of appointments. I effectively had to choose between using days on appointments to navigate my PCOS and saving days for a hoped-for future maternity leave. When I finally got pregnant, I had 12 days. You can bet I guarded them jealously. I delayed doctor-recommended care throughout my pregnancy. When we learned Judy was breech, I couldn't avoid using sick time. As I was in the hospital for an ECV, an incredibly painful procedure, I was in the waiting room stressed out that I was burning a day of leave. At the appointment for the second attempt, when we learned it was going to be impossible to flip her because her cord was wrapped around her neck, I cried because I would need a C-section, but I also cried because I had wasted 2 days on a failed procedure. Judy was born 2 weeks early by emergency C-section. I had 10 days of paid leave to be with her. 5 of those days was spent in the hospital. It wasn't enough. Giving birth is not a health-neutral event. I couldn't walk down the hall after 10 days, let alone run a classroom of 33 teenagers. Teachers devote their lives and careers to serving our communities and nurturing the minds that will serve society in the future. We take care of the community's children. We deserve time to take care of our own. There is a teacher shortage sweeping the country. If Minnesota wants to attract and retain high-quality teachers, the state needs to be a place where teachers are treated with dignity and respect, where we can imagine building our family's future. At Egan High School, we teach our students to lead by example. If Minnesota wants to be a leader in education, if the state values its families, we need to protect paid family leave and not delay the implementation of this important program that Minnesotans are planning on accessing. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will have Sarah Mullins, after which we will have Claudia Gordon. Sarah, if you will identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Mullins. I'm a chemist, and I live in St. Paul. I am excited for the paid family medical leave program to start on January 1st, 2026, and I oppose any delay to the program start. A few years ago, late on a Saturday night, I received one of those calls that disrupts your life. My dad was in the hospital. For 73 years, he had been the picture of good health, and now he was having seizures. After many tests, a brain surgery, a biopsy, we learned that it was a glioblastoma, an inoperable version of that brain tumor. Radiation and chemo didn't stop the growth, and within 3 months from the diagnosis, he passed away. It was a real shock to me and to my family. My mom was just recovering from a hip replacement surgery, and she couldn't manage the day-to-day needs on her own. I had to travel back and forth to Kansas City to help with everything from doctor's appointments to changes in the house to accommodate my dad's new needs, everything from just unsteady and unbalanced, I mean, all kinds of things going haywire when you have a brain tumor. So this happened at the end of the year. A new calendar year came about. That meant that I had a new allotment of vacation days that I could spend to travel back and forth to Kansas City to do this. But overall, managing my time away was so much harder than it needed to be. It was a week-to-week negotiation with my boss. When I would have preferred, and I actually asked if I could take an extended leave. And, you know, my story is, it's sad for me personally and what I went through. But as I've talked to many others, this is actually really, really common. I mean, having to take care of an aging parent, I mean, this is what happens to human bodies, right? And we don't get to choose the timing of it. So, and I know that this is happening to people all across the state, all kinds of jobs and income levels and situations. And the key thing here is I didn't get to choose the timing, right? And it was the thing I missed out on was actually any quality time with my dad before he passed away, because every single minute I had to squeeze in for the care, right? The medical care and the appointments. So a different employer or boss might have granted the extended leave I needed. Paid family medical leave as a state policy brings consistency so that employees know what we can request and we can engage in that. So I really value that foundation. I think that really helps employees tremendously. It helps us care for our families in these emergencies while also being able to retain our ability to do our jobs and return to the work that we train to do. So I encourage you to implement the paid family medical leave on the original timeline. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Claudia, after which we will then have a Zoom participant, Jessica Peterson-White. If you could identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. I am here to oppose delaying paid family medical leave, which is supposed to start January 1st. My name is Claudia Gordon. I'm from St. Paul, and this is my story. I have a son, Hunter, who is 40 years old. He is married, has a daughter who is 13 and a half, has a son who is soon to be 11, and has another son who is going to be 8. 6 years ago, he was diagnosed with glioblastoma, brain cancer, grade 4, and aggressive. He underwent surgery within 2.5 days of his diagnosis. He was on chemotherapy. He did radiation. And for 2.5 years, he wore an Optune device on his head. But that became uncomfortable because then he had shingles on his face. So between the two, it was miserable for him. His oncologist said, "You can take off the Optune device if you want to, Hunter." And he said, "What do the studies say?" And she said, "There are no studies." Glioblastoma victims, patients, usually last 12 to 18 months from diagnosis at Hunter's age. 5% last 5 years. Hunter is a miracle. But when he was diagnosed, he started having aura seizures afterwards. After his chemo, after his radiation, after everything was done, he started having aura seizures. And he cannot work. So he is on disability, but his wife works full time. He has aura seizures daily and multiple times during the day. And so far, medication is not helping him. So we are hoping for a miracle for Hunter. His two sisters relocated here. We are Team Hunter as a family, helping, going to be there for him. But if that miracle starts to fade, we need to have the ability, the chance to take care of Hunter at home, in his home. If the miracle starts to fade, Hunter deserves the chance to be cared for by his family in his home. It is still almost a year away from the original implementation of this paid family medical leave. 2 years is what this bill would authorize it to be delayed by. I don't know if we have 2 years. Please give us a chance to care for my son, for his family, in his home. And please say no to delaying this bill. Thank you. And I do have time left over if anybody has questions, too.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Good luck with Hunter.
Thank you. Next, we will have Jessica Peterson-White on Zoom, after which we will have Sarah Pippenberg. If you could identify yourself, Jessica, and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you. It looks like my video is off, but anyway, thank you all for hearing from me today and allowing me to testify remotely. Great. I can start my video now. Thank you. I'm Jessica Peterson-White. I own Content Bookstore and Kids Content in Northfield, and I serve on the Northfield City Council. And I'm here today to ask you to allow the state to continue moving forward on schedule with our paid family and medical leave program, which small businesses and our employees so desperately need. When my son Thorsten was born in 2016, my business was pretty new, and I budgeted to have about a month at home, and then I eased back into work. It was too expensive to cover all my hours with other people, so I spent many days at the shop with a baby in my arms or with him napping in the baby bucket behind the counter. Lyra, my youngest, was born in March of 2020, and while I'd planned carefully so that I could be home for 10 weeks after that with the pandemic, my maternity leave lasted just a week. And then I was working harder than ever to make sure my bookstore survived that crisis. Self-employment has given me flexibility, but I've made painful trade-offs between investing in my business and caring for my babies. In 2018, the city of Northfield passed a 6-week paid family leave policy for city employees. We're really proud of our policy, but we also know it's not enough. 6 weeks isn't enough to be at home with a newborn, and it's often not enough to care for folks with the kind of complex care situations that you've heard from others about today. We're constrained as a city, as an employer, because our pool is small. A statewide fund is exactly what we need to protect us all from big variations in costs. Some folks that you've heard from today will claim to represent, who claim to represent the interests of Minnesota businesses, will try to tell you that the statewide insurance pool that this bill creates for paid family and medical leave is somehow bad for business. From my perspective, as a small employer and a retailer, it's just the opposite. My business needs this program in order to compete on a level playing field, and we need it urgently. I provide great jobs, and many of my employers in their 20s and 30s would love to keep working for me and have kids, but they're likely to leave us to work for a much larger business when they do, because those big businesses can provide paid leave. They have a bigger pool. A statewide program is the right tool to help my business compete for the best employees. Paid leave would ensure that when my employees need to care for their families, they can then return ready for work while my business has the resources to cover their responsibilities, making my business stronger and more resilient. I think it's short-sighted at best to claim that this program represents only a cost to businesses like mine. The folks who are referring to this as just a big expense aren't quantifying the cost they're already suffering from losing great employees when they have a baby or when people need to care for a sick relative. We've heard today from some testifiers that businesses they represent can't bear the cost of allowing employees to stay home when they need to at all, apparently. So what are they doing now? Do they not hire people with children? Do they not hire people of childbearing age? Do they, as we heard today, ask people if they plan to have a baby before they hire them? That would be illegal. Or do they just expect their employees to come to work a week after giving birth? I don't know what kind of backup plan these folks have, but it's unclear to me how it's working out for their workforce in the current state of things. I view this as this paid family medical leave program as a tool I desperately need and that other small businesses need, and I'm happy to invest in it because it will provide stability to my workforce. Furthermore, contrary to some of the narratives presented here today, my employees understand very well what will be available with this program, and they're eager to have access to this resource. We're already facing costs in so many ways around folks taking leave and having the resources to cover those. We just need a good way to handle those costs sustainably, and this program would provide that. I hope we can all agree that babies shouldn't go to daycare 2 weeks or 6 weeks after they're born, and it's not humane to force a new mom back to work at that point either, but most working parents don't have a choice right now, especially those working for small businesses, because they can't afford to skip a few paychecks. Employees at small businesses shouldn't have to do this, while folks who work for bigger businesses don't. That's bad for families, it's bad for business, it's bad for our economy. We need a system that keeps family income steady during those precious early months, and we need it as soon as possible. Implementation of this program is on track and well underway. We can't afford 2 more years of lacking this program. Please allow it to continue to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Sarah, and then on the deck we have another Zoom participant, Lynn, pardon me if I'm getting this wrong, but Gort.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Piepenberg, and I am the co-owner of Vinaigrette, a family-owned retail food store located in southwest Minneapolis. I am proud to be a small business owner that helped lead the fight for paid leave over the last 8 years. I testified in dozens of committee hearings, was part of countless hours of legislative debate, and was thrilled when the bill was signed into law in 2023. I got into this fight because of my employee, Linda, and many of you committee members have heard our story, so I'll try to make it brief. She fell. She needed to be out for 12 weeks. If she went without her paycheck from us while she was out recovering, she was going to have to choose between putting food on the table and making rent. We paid her while she was out because it was the right thing to do. Paying her saved me money in having to hire and train a new employee, but caused us to be late on our commercial rent and our house payment. It was a real struggle. Linda, however, came back twice the amazing employee she already was because she was allowed to heal without the stress of finances. My story with Linda continued as she went on to be diagnosed with ALS and I became her primary caregiver. I would get up daily and drive from northeast Minneapolis to Chanhassen to get her out of bed, dress her, toilet her, make her breakfast, and then go to Vinaigrette to work, to travel back to Chanhassen to put her to bed at night. When it became painfully evident that ALS was taking her body, we had to search for long-term care. Long-term care turned into having to transfer to a hospice house where she died May of 2021. I can't help but think of how different the end of her life would have been if there was a paid leave policy that would have allowed some of her family members to care for her. It shouldn't have been a battle for her family to take time off to hold Linda's hands as she took her last breath. Minnesota paid leave will help ensure Minnesotans don't need to choose between financial stability and being there for their families. In addition, changing the implementation timeline introduces new uncertainty for small business owners like me. The rest of the world and 12 other states have already figured out how to provide paid leave. Minnesota is just over 10 months away from full implementation. Families are already counting on this benefit. New parents who give birth or adopt a baby as soon as right now will be eligible for leave starting January 1st, 2026. Delaying would be cruel to the thousands of Minnesotans who are counting on this leave, and it isn't necessary. We have a child care crisis in Minnesota. This paid leave policy would lift the newborn care burden for the first 3 months, possibly 6 months. Black women are the most gainfully employed population, not a narrative we've ever really been told. Being the most gainfully employed population, 80% are the primary income earner as well as the primary caregiver. A baby born to a working black mother has a 29% increased risk of death due to failure to thrive simply because their mother goes back to work too soon and without adequate child care. Minnesota passed a paid leave policy that will end that statistic. Do not delay implementation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, we'll have Lynn Gort on Zoom, after which we will have Roger Sheldon on Zoom as well. You may proceed and identify yourself for the tape, please.
Hello, good morning. This is Chair Baker and committee members. My name is Lynn Gort, and I'm the co-owner of Northern Water Smokehouse in Duluth. We have been in business for 27 years and currently have 50 employees. And we ask you to continue on the existing timeline, and we oppose House File 11. Owning a food-based hospitality and retail business is extremely challenging and stressful. We have managed over the years, especially during COVID, by focusing on our employees and on employee retention. This is really key to our business model and why we tend to have a reputation for product consistency, food safety, and excellent customer service. We could use the paid family and leave program right now to offset the financial burden for employees with longer-term health challenges. We do our best to support our employees because it's the right thing to do. We want them and their families to be healthy, but also to retain them. But this is very difficult for us to do, and we are unable to offer anything as extensive as this benefit. The design of this program took years of careful consideration, debate, and extensive analysis of the cost, the benefit, and the analysis of risk shared between employers and employees. As a smaller employer, we feel that our cost of this benefit is reasonable and that the benefit of for our employees far outweighs the cost. We feel that this is one of the most consequential pro-business programs developed in the state in decades, and the implementation in 2026 provides another year for us to get ready. Our business perspective is not aligned with many of those shared today. We are not anxious about how this program will be implemented. We also think that DEED will have time to address the important labor-related questions that were asked here today. We do not see the need to delay the implementation of this critical program. We do not need an additional year to implement systems of compliance. As a business owner, our employees and their families need this benefit as soon as possible. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, Roger Sheldon, if you can identify yourself when you proceed, and then Guadalupe Lopez will be after that.
Hello, Chair Baker, Lead Pinto, representatives and guests. Can you hear me?
Good morning.
Yes, we can.
Good deal. I'm Roger Sheldon, a veteran of about 40 years in newborn intensive care pediatrics, otherwise known as neonatology. I'm here to speak for my favorite people, the just-born children and their families, some of the people who need paid family and medical leave the most, and to share the message of the Minnesota Prenatal to Three Coalition, Doctors for Early Childhood, and the Minnesota Rally to Read, among others. This program was passed and promised by you, the House, the Senate, and the governor to hundreds of thousands of parents and relatives across the state. People are depending on this great new approach to do right by their newborns and sick relatives. People are planning their families and making life-altering decisions based on this promise. We have only one chance to give young children a healthy start in life. More than 60,000 new Minnesotans are born each year needing this paid family and medical leave statute. If there are defects or adjustments that need to be made, I submit that it is your responsibility to do that, not to delay the improvements. If we delay, we deny those 60,000 families the opportunity, and we take away their child's benefit. Sure, it costs money. That's because it's highly valuable for the child, the parents, and our whole state. Early childhood development and successful parenting are most dependent on the first 3 to 4 years. This program is a multi-purpose way to address parent attachment, literacy — have you checked your district's reading scores lately? — numerous health risks, juvenile crime, and incarceration. You may say you want to fix all these issues. This delay will delay all those fixes. Your institutional legislative horizon is about 25 years too short to evaluate how to help the earliest childhood population and improve how much they will be able to achieve. Think big. Think long. Think 25 to 30 years long, when these children will be most of our workforce and our economic promise. Listen to the kids and to the many states, both red and blue, and many other countries who have successfully implemented these policies. Your concerns are likely solved by those places. Ask how they did it. It's a competitive advantage for the state and a competitive advantage for the nation. Let's get going so your reports and evaluations in the bill can proceed. We are doing a truly poor job for our youngest children. This is the logical first step. Let's get on with it. Thank you.
Thank you. After Guadalupe, we will have another Zoom participant, Reverend Corrine Friedman Ellis. If you would proceed by identifying yourself. Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Guadalupe Lopez. I'm the Executive Director of Violence Free Minnesota. I represent our 90-member programs across the state of Minnesota that provide direct services and to domestic violence victims and survivors across the state. The services include shelter safety, planning, counseling, legal systems, navigation, and other wraparound services. I want to share a statistic with you. If you look around the room and just in this room, 1 out of 3 women experience domestic violence or sexual violence. 1 out of 4 men will experience sexual violence or in domestic violence, and those are national statistics. And we are just in this room if we just look around. I want to say that I'm here today to testify in opposition of House File 11. Domestic violence victims will benefit greatly from paid safety leave. Research has shown that a vast majority of people who experience domestic violence have financial abuse as part of their experience. Limiting survivors to economic options limits their opportunities to access safety and contributes to the establishment of the abuse party's power and control over the survivor. Not having safety leave available to survivors creates a threat of financial instability and prevents survivors from accessing services that can help address immediate and potentially life-threatening situations. We do a report every year around the Intimate Partner Homicide Report that shows every death that we record in Minnesota. Obtain legal and other assistance needed to flee abusive situations and to secure stability and after leaving an abusive relationship in order to avoid the risk of returning to abusive situation. I also read a report from the National Domestic Hotline that 70%, and this is an old report, but it's like there's nothing current as of right now. In 2005, they reported over 70% of workforce do not have plans for survivors escaping or surviving violence. So I just want to also add that in there. The Paid Family Medical Leave Program establishes vital support for survivors of domestic abuse and should not be delayed. It provides survivors with the employment security and financial protection they need to address the health and safety for themselves and their families. We urge you to vote no on House File 11. Miigwech.
Thank you. Next will be our last Zoom participant, after which we will have Bernie Bernman on deck. If you could identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Corinne Friedman Ellis, and I serve as lead pastor at Peace United Church of Christ in Duluth. I'm also a mom to 2 amazing kids, ages 6 and 3, and I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 11. As a minister, a parent, and a person of faith, I believe every person deserves the dignity of paid family and medical leave, and that we shouldn't have to wait any longer. We as Minnesotans are resilient. We make it work. We don't complain. But I'm going to complain on our behalf right now. We have been fighting for this policy for a decade at this point, and we need it to roll out on its promised timeline. I started testifying in favor of paid family and medical leave 6 years ago when I was an associate pastor in St. Paul with a 3-month-old strapped to my chest, coming off my own lucky 12 weeks of paid leave and feeling in my bones how impossible it would have been to return to work 2 weeks after giving birth, like so many Minnesota moms have to. Later, I ended up leaving the workforce for 1.5 years to focus on my children's health. I know that a statewide leave policy could have kept me working. Right now, I supervise 8 staff members, all hard workers, gifted at what they do and crucial to our ministry here. One of those staff members is the mom of a toddler with all the associated daycare illnesses who manages her own chronic illness. And on top of all of that, her partner was diagnosed last summer with stage 3 cancer. We've worked hard to support her and keep her employed here and paid consistently, but I can't tell you how many times I've said this year, if only our paid family and medical leave program were up and running. It would have saved the church, our staff member, and me as a supervisor so much time and stress, and we believe money as well. Paid family and medical leave helps churches, nonprofits, and small businesses support and retain their employees and also live into their values despite tight budgets. Paid family and medical leave touches all of our lives. Unfortunately, I don't think that the bill before us now is about delaying paid family and medical leave. I worry that it's about creating enough opposition against it to get rid of it altogether. I urge you not to delay the rollout of this crucial policy so that all Minnesota families can thrive. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Ms. Burnham, after which will be Ben Baglio. If you could prepare and if you identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Bernie Burnham, and I am the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a federation of unions who represent more than 300,000 working people in every corner of our state. It's on behalf of these union members and every working Minnesotan that I speak against House File 11. Minnesota's paid leave program, set to take effect next year, did not appear out of thin air. This program is more than a decade in the making, thanks to advocates across the state, many who are here in this room this morning. After passing multiple legislative committees and chambers over that decade, it finally reached the governor's desk in 2023. Then, in 2024, modifications were made at the legislature to ensure this program is ready to go on January 1st, 2026. This legislation has been one of the most vetted and dissected pieces of legislation in state history. We understood, however, that the state needed time to properly implement this groundbreaking policy. With 11 months remaining for the paid leave program to take effect, working Minnesotans are ready for the peace of mind that comes from knowing we will have the freedom to care for ourselves and the people we love without sacrificing a paycheck. Working people understand that no program is going to be perfect, and if after it takes effect, there are things that need to be looked at, tweaks can then be made. But let's get it off the ground. There's a lot of things we could not do, and nothing would ever happen. This is important to keep moving. However, we see the delay in this bill for what it is, a veiled attempt backed by some employers from big business, counties, and school districts to take away paid leave from working Minnesotans before we even have it. For those who are not understanding how paid family medical leave interacts with collective bargaining agreements, I invite you to give us a call. We are happy, and I'm sure our affiliated unions would be happy to sit down with you as well. We urge this committee to reject House File 11 today. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Ben Baglio, and then Sarah Gagelhoff will be on deck. If you identify yourself and please proceed.
Good morning, Chairman, committee members. Thank you for allowing me to testify this morning on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association, or MNA, which represents more than 22,000 nurses working at the bedside in hospitals across our state, which rounds out to about 4 out of every 5 nurses in Minnesota hospitals today. MNA was proud to be part of the coalition that worked for years to pass the paid family medical leave program. Among other reasons, MNA supported establishing the paid leave program for 3 big reasons. First, the paid leave program provides relief to our members, many of which would not otherwise have access to anywhere near this amount of paid leave. With 15,000 nurses across the metro and Duluth preparing to enter contract negotiations this year with the largest healthcare systems in our state, I can promise you that this is the case. They need you to protect it. They wouldn't otherwise have that leave. And as President Burnham just said, frankly, we're pretty sure the employers have the legal resources available to them to understand what was in the law around collective bargaining. It's pretty clear. The second big reason why we support paid leave as well as earned safe and sick time is because they keep us safer. Nurses, everyone else in the hospital, everyone else in the community, it keeps us healthier and safer. But you can't do it unless you can afford it, and no one should ever go into financial ruin because they, their family members, which includes chosen family, got sick. And the third big reason we support paid leave is because we know that it's the best way to provide working families with the flexibility needed not only to maintain secure employment, but to do things like family planning and having children. People are planning on starting to try to have kids next month because of the rollout. I hope you all take that into consideration. We hear a lot of talk about needing a robust workforce from the employer groups, but they're certainly doing a lot to prevent the growth of working families. I think this attention and time would be better served focus on supporting and retaining workers, which is something has been neglected, certainly across healthcare, but across the workforce as well. Make no mistake, the paid leave program will help more nurses return to the bedside after going on leave. Gutting the program or delaying it by a year unnecessarily will do just the opposite. It doesn't really surprise us at this point to see hospitals also working to gut paid leave, given how hospital executives treat nurses, although, again, we'd encourage them to work more on supporting nurses rather than fighting them here on this issue. But it would surprise us is if we saw legislators that typically have sided with working families and labor doing a 180 this session and siding with the big employer groups this time. I want to conclude by reiterating that 15,000 union M&A nurses are in the process for preparing for contract negotiations with most of the largest hospital systems in our state this year. Those contracts are being bargained, and the delay of a year to the paid family medical leave program undermines those bargaining efforts. It jeopardizes nurses who have personally planned accordingly for this benefit to take place, and it only further tips the scales in favor of the bosses in this year's negotiations. I hope that that's not what the legislature chooses to do. In closing, we oppose unnecessary delays to implementation as well as any carve-outs. And remember, chosen family is family, and no employer is too small to ensure dignity for their workers. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Next, we will have Sarah, after which we will have Jackie Lane. Sarah, if you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Gangelhoff, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Innovation at the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. We are part of the coalition that supported paid leave, and we're here today to oppose its delay. In the past 42 years, we have invested more than $54 million in communities across Minnesota and advanced policy to create a state where women, girls, and their families thrive. We know from our research in our Status of Women and Girls in Minnesota report and from listening to communities that families and medical leave is key to long-term success for both individuals and for the greater economy, as it actually leads to increased productivity and labor force participation. Economic studies show that access to paid leave increases the likelihood that workers will return to their jobs instead of dropping out of the labor force entirely. Mothers with access to leave can also have a positive impact on their children's health and development. Many Minnesota's mothers are the primary breadwinners for the family. 58% of black mothers, 46% of Native American mothers, 41% of Latina mothers are the heads of their households. And yet their work is not only poorly compensated, it lacks basic benefits. Our data shows women are concentrated in low-wage occupations like service industries, where benefits are scarce, the work is hard, and pay is low. And women of color dominate these fields. Barbara Ehrenreich called women in low-wage occupations anonymous donors to society for what they personally sacrifice to work in these sectors. Now this bill is asking them to sacrifice once again by waiting another year before paid leave is implemented. To achieve economic security and a fair economic playing field, we must value the work and the roles that women provide by compensating, at minimum, her right to take a leave and return to the workplace without financial penalty or loss of opportunity. Investing in women now benefits children, families, and the entire community in the long term. Women in Minnesota are ready for paid leave, and we do not support pushing back the launch date. We must support our workers in the labor force and our state's economic growth now by not delaying them family and medical leave. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Jackie Lane, after which will be Summer Spica. If you can identify yourself and please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jackie Lane, and I am here as a parent and representative of Take Action Minnesota to urge you to support working families by preserving the 2026 launch date of the paid family and medical leave program. The delay as proposed in this bill is unnecessary and not in Minnesotans' best interest. After having my first child, Wren, I took out student loans to survive the 12 weeks that I stayed at home with her. Combined with 3 months of lost wages and interest, my maternity leave totals at a cost of $17,000, money I did not have, money that produces the next generation of workers for Minnesota's economy. Then at 16 months old, Wren was diagnosed with medical conditions that required 3 surgeries, 3 months in a full body cast, 3 months of physical therapy 3 times a week, all so that she could take her first steps at 2 years old. I left the workforce to care for her. despite a string of academic achievements and being accepted into a dual degree master's PhD program, I am unable to return to the workforce without the security of paid family and medical leave due to my daughter's potential need for future surgeries. With or without a formal education, how many parents are excluded from contributing their talents and dedication to the workforce based on unpredictable circumstances? But I'm not here just to tell my story. I am here as a leader with Take Action and Minnesota United Parents, where over the past 2 years, we have mobilized thousands of parents in support of policies that families desperately need: paid sick days, paid family and medical leave, and affordable child care. Paid family and medical leave is one of the most meaningful ways we can support working families. I needed this program back in 2020 as much as it is needed in 2026. Thank you.
Thank you. And next will be Summer, after which we will then move to member questions. Just a reminder, we do have this room after session today, so we will come back up roughly at 5. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, my name is Summer Spica. I live in St. Paul, and I am a union organizer and a home care worker. I am here on behalf of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota in Iowa. Our union represents over 55,000 healthcare workers around the state. We work in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We oppose House File 11 because it is an unneeded delay of a critical benefit. 1 year may seem like a short time, but if you are a new mother waking up multiple times a night to feed your crying baby, a year is very long. Now add a full-time job on top of sleepless nights, and it gets much longer. It is likely that over 60,000 women will give birth in 2026. Most of them will want to use paid leave. Many have made important decisions about finances, marriage, and jobs because they expect to use paid leave. This bill derails those plans. I know how important the first year of motherhood can be. I got involved in organizing home care workers because I didn't get leave after having a baby when I was a PCA. In 2014, I was a PCA and I was pregnant with my youngest daughter, Amalia. Like most home care workers, before we got a union, I didn't have any paid leave at all, and I only made $10.50 an hour. I had worked hard and saved as much as I could, but I could only afford 2 weeks without a paycheck. That included the 4 days I was in the hospital after my C-section. So 2 weeks after major surgery, I was back to work as a PCA. Being a PCA is hard physical work when you are in good shape. Bending, lifting, bathing, feeding, not to mention the other changes your body is going through. After surgery, this work is brutal. No one should have to make that choice, even for just another year. This delay is unnecessary. Our union works with employers large and small all over the state. We have been talking to employers about the new benefit. Some employers are eager to roll this out, and others don't like it. But no employer has told us that they can't meet the deadline or that we should not expect it to start on time. We have also worked closely with the Department of Employment and Economic Development to educate our members. They tell us they can start on time, and we have been checking their progress. If there were grounds for delay, we would raise them. America is the only country with no paid leave for workers. Minnesotans have waited too long already. We don't need to delay it anymore.
Thank you. Now we will go to member questions. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Baker, for Chair Baker, for bringing this and this being our first bill, because I think that from the testimony we heard, it reminds us how important this policy is and how it is rooted in the lives of people. I've been hearing this bill since I first started in the legislature. This will be my third term, and when we passed it in May 2023. And I just, especially to the folks who testified about their stories, I have a lot of questions about that I think I'll save until after the break, but I did want to, particularly to Sarah Mullins and Claudia Gordon,
The thing about this bill is, and this policy is, we all have our stories. And I remember being 29, and my dad was dying of multiple myeloma, and he was 59. And it was very sudden. Like, it was something he got, and and we were down at Mayo, and I was in law school, and my sister was an ICU nurse, so she was 24, and she was burning through her PTO. And I remember sitting on a bench, having a conversation where we got really bad news and trying to figure out how she was going to pay for the time that she needed when I went back to law school to stay with my dad. And we were lucky in that, I had spent some time at a law firm, and my dad kicked in a little bit, but most people don't have that. And just having to have that conversation, well, what you really wanted to be focusing on is that you had months left with your dad, was really hard. And nobody should have to go through that. And we have the means and the policy to make sure people don't have to go through that. And so that was in 2009. The idea of waiting one more year, when we still have 10 months to figure out all this stuff, is something we shouldn't tolerate. So I appreciate the bill. I appreciate Representative Frazier, all the work you've done on it, and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you. I don't see any more questions.
Mr. Chair, yeah, so I think we'll, I know we've got a whole bunch of questions and we're trying to sort of figure out about timing. Did you want, the chair want us to keep on going till 10? Did you at this point, we're going to recess and come back? Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I think we can have the room till 10:05 if you think we can get there. Otherwise, we can pause, we can take a break, or we can just keep piling through it if you want to. So it's up to you. We'll go wherever you want.
And Mr. Chair and Chair Mecklenburg, I don't think we'll be able to get done by 10:05, okay. I will say. I probably have enough stuff myself to fill that. I think I've got some colleagues as well. And so I'll maybe look to colleagues to see if folks would want to go forward now or would want to just have us come back. I will say, Mr. Chair and folks in the room, it is not our intent to – we're not expecting this is going to go deep into the night, but 10 minutes I don't think is going to work for it. So,
And to that, Mr. Chair, and then Resident Pinto and members, I think this is a good time to take a recess now to the call of the chair. Okay. I want to just also thank the testifiers for coming in. Your voice is the most important thing here today from both sides of this issue. That's why this is so important to get it right. And so I look forward to talking to all members here. Again, I will be reaching out to Representative Pinto, Representative Frazier, because this is sort of our idea of a what if nothing changes, we can look at this. Because we think that we actually have some ideas that we can still roll something out, but we want to visit with you now quickly, like next week. But we're 24 days into session, members. We have to get moving, so time is ticking, and we have a lot of questions. So I look forward to that, Mr. Chair. So if you want to do your recess motion, and then we'll do that at that point tonight.
Thank you, Representative Baker. So we will now be in recess to the call of chair, which should be roughly 5 p.m. to this afternoon, evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to call this back to order, Representative Baker.
Yeah, we're all getting used to that, aren't we? Calling this meeting back to order, this hearing. Representative Baker, if you don't have any further comments, we can get back to member questions.
That would be my preference, Mr. Chair. I'll be happy to take questions from members.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Baker. P. Johnson, I believe you're on the list next.
Thank you, Chair Mecklen, Chair Baker. Reading this bill, I wasn't here for the last 2 years. I'm new to this, and the bill before us is really quite simple. It literally changes the number from a 6 to a 7, delaying this by a year. But one thing that I'm really realizing rapidly here is that sometimes the simplest language in these bills is the most loaded. So I want to thank a lot of them aren't here, but I want to thank the testifiers for sharing their stories and their concerns, and it does help bring some of this into light. And one of the things that I picked up on from a lot of these testifiers and the employers and HR and things like that is the value of a collective bargaining agreement and a union contract. As somebody who both benefits from those contracts and negotiates those, I see employers talk about how those are used to protect workers in this situation so they have the leave to take care of their family members. But it's also rare that those benefits don't come under attack every single time we try to negotiate them. We're constantly forced to defend them, both in negotiations and in out. So that's one of my big concerns is many of these testifiers talk not about how this delay would be used to prepare and implement this this plan, but more they talked about their concerns. They picked apart parts they don't like and problems with it. So my question is how do we take this at face value that it's written solely to delay to allow for this thing to be implemented and not a continued attempt to undermine it and weaken it and continue to chop it apart where it won't have its continued benefit?
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, that's a great question, and I think it's extremely appropriate for you to ask those kind of questions because you didn't kind of live through the last at least couple of years where it was really evident that this very big program, which is, again, really recognizing the need for family support, for medical support, and if the employers, which is going to be a major part of this, really its minimum is going to be 50% of this, has to also kind of see where it's going to work, how they're going to pay for it, how they're going to kind of bake it in. So you're right, the slightest words can change a whole direction of things. A shall to a may, you're going to see that a lot around here. The delay in this bill is meant to get it right before it leaves, because what we can do is keep working with this kind of a bill. When it's sitting on the House floor, we can add amendments, we can change things on the way. The one thing that I have shared very openly with Lee Pinto is that my ability to keep working this is to actually try to find better ways, more ways, to make the bill even better and how it actually gets the other side, the part of business that also has to be viable. Or Representative Johnson, we're not going to have jobs for them to come back to. They have to at least say, I can see where this is going to work. So a delay is giving us a pause to work on this more. I am not convinced DEED is ready. I'm not convinced the fiscal notes were done properly. I'm not convinced that the language is right because there's still too many questions coming in. They have not convinced me, certainly, that they're ready to go. We need to have conversations in this committee about where is the IT system at right now? Is the governor getting updates, regular updates? Are we getting regular updates? When are we going to know the system has been actually really tested properly by people in the IT world that know what that even looks like? And it's not me. Until we see those kind of things, Rep. Johnson, I'm just using this as sort of a, we're going to make sure we get it right before it goes out the door. Thank you for the question.
Representative Johnson, do you have a follow-up?
I do. So the follow-up I have is one of the things that we've encountered, I am fortunate to have a benefit that is comparable or a little better than what we're talking about here. And one of the things that that we have seen is continued pressure on the city of Duluth because so many other folks don't have that benefit. So when somebody has to take leave, it is always the city employee who has that benefit, in essence supplementing those employers that don't provide a benefit that is robust. So how do we, my question to Chair Baker, I guess, is how do we stop that continued burden on those employers that do currently have it and where only one side of that family is eligible to take that leave?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I have to maybe could you, I'm not sure I follow the questioning.
Sure.
Sorry.
Representative Johnson.
So, Chair Baker, with my employer has a strong leave provision, and if something happened to one of my kids, I would be the one that would take leave. So it would be the city of Duluth that would be paying all the overtime and all the backfill to cover me, paying all those benefits, where my spouse works for an employer that does not have a plan that is nearly so robust. So all of that continued pressure to the current employers that offer those benefits, are you concerned at all about those employers continuing to bear the full brunt of the leave for the individuals in these families?
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the clarity. I think that that's something in the system right now that, again, a lot of collective bargaining agreements are set up for just those good, robust programs that you're fortunate to have. A lot of people don't have that, and there's for many reasons they don't have it. To have this fairness thing, I think, come up is what we're trying to get down to, is to what is fair, but what is also affordable to everybody that has to participate. Any members in either a public union, maybe such as yourself, that they've negotiated over years with this kind of a robust PTO program, the question now becomes, that I'm hearing from others, is, well, I already got the program. I don't know that I want to pay a tax for a program that I'm already getting. And that'd be a question for you and your colleagues that fight fires and are doing those kind of things. Those are the questions that we want to make sure we get it right. Do you want to have a double program and pay for more, or are you happy with what you have? We're never going to get it right because there's so many thousands of businesses in the state of Minnesota. Everyone is unique. Some are seasonal, some are not. And some are public, some are not. Some are small, some are brand new, some are massive. What we're trying to get to is what is that fairness look like? And another reason that you're bringing up is why I think we just need to make sure we get it right so that we look at the other side to get this, so that your spouse, for example, has something that they can use that is actually maybe right fitted. It may not be the same, but it should be something. But we're trying to get to something. But I appreciate the question. Yeah.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Next on the list would be Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Baker for bringing this bill and for the discussion that we're having today. I also want to thank all the testifiers who shared, including it's great to see Duluthians on the board today. You know, and reflecting on the work that we did to bring this bill and pass it after decades of Minnesotans organizing for the benefit of paid family medical leave, I was struck by something I heard in testimony earlier that, you know, it's a need to protect public interest and promote economic growth. And as somebody who has spent a number of years in background in business administration, I also believe that, you know, health is wealth. And that is everything we do is economic development, including the health and wellness of our employees, of our communities. And a lot of research has gone in to show the benefits of paid family medical leave, especially as we heard in testimony that we look at our workforce shortages. You know, we just had our St. Louis County Days at the Capitol, and workforce development and the workforce crisis is a real issue facing us. And we've heard over and over from our employers and childcare sector that a big part of it is that if we could keep, you know, women and parent birthing people in the workplace, and that paid family medical leave leads to 20% less leaving the workforce. I also am here on the workforce committee and in this work because I really believe that Minnesota is a place where everybody should have a affordable place to call home, that we should have ample job opportunities, and we know that well, not reflected here, I think our job is also connect the dots to the economic system and systems that we have in housing. And when we talk to people who are facing homelessness or facing housing instability and keeping people in their homes, having a job that can pay the rent and pay your mortgage and keeping that, but medical debt that could be proactively resolved through paid family medical leave shows that 13% of single-parent families and 25% of those in dual incomes are filing for bankruptcy, which is causing people to lose their jobs, causing them to lose their homes. And so having this benefit not only makes sure that we're taking care of our workforce, but that we're keeping people in their homes. I mean, I want to make sure that we're really clear of why we're doing this and how that actually goes to support the overall economic development in our community, in our state. And so to the question, I'm curious, as we've heard from many different groups coming before us today, is what feedback, Representative, have you taken from workers and labor groups in talking with state agencies that would necessitate us having a delay? And then what are we to say to Minnesotans who trusted us, who are making plans to utilize these benefits that would necessitate their waiting?
Yeah.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kozlowski, thank you for the question. It's a very good one. I think that what I've heard the last 2 years is, yeah, there is a real need to have an understanding that we can do something better in Minnesota to try to find a way to give very important benefits that fit the employer, to best fit that employer to make sure that they can operate this, whether it's by choice, whether it's by right-sizing it. But what I've learned in this world that I live in Economics 101 is not everybody gets paid $50 an hour. Not everybody has the ability to do those kinds of things in the industries that they are choosing to work in. Not everybody has the ability to work in a small employer and have that flexibility and get to know the owner-manager. And in large employers, they can offer a lot of different things for different reasons because they have maybe more global revenues and things. I think there's just so many slices to your question because these stories are heartbreaking. They really are. As an employer myself, I want to make sure they all have that time at home. But I will tell you, if we don't get it right, to get them out of poverty, to get them to the housing that you're talking about, they need to have a really good job. They need a good job with good benefits. We're talking about benefits. If we don't give them the good job before the benefits, we won't have anything to offer them, period. And my fear is, the last couple of years, the majority did not listen to that side of things very well at all. I've heard that numerous times. And I think my marching orders in my mind, in my heart, is that of all the things that I've heard around the state the last couple of years, oh, my God, we got to get this right. And so my plea to my DFL colleagues is to make sure that we talk about how do we make this so that the employers who are minimum 50% of this benefit and whatever size this is, we got to make sure that they can have some buy-in too because they have not been heard in the last 2 years. That's a really, really big deal. So I'm just trying to find this balance to get this to work. Because again, once it's out, we can't, it's going to be a lot harder to change. I want to make sure that we hit that right sweet spot.
Representative Kowalski.
Yeah. Thanks, Chair and Representative Baker. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I appreciate that we want to get things right. And also, I think about the years and years that Minnesotans have waited for this benefit, and we've heard from small businesses today, or like I said, in my own backyard, who said, we're ready. DEED is ready. We're on track. And I think about the Minnesotans who don't have time. You know, I'm a real big James Baldwin fan, and that echoes real true in my life. My brother didn't have time. My mom didn't have time to wait around for these benefits. I think about myself, and I appreciate that Rep. Greenman was very personal in sharing his story. Myself, as a victim survivor, it's MMIR week. I appreciate that Violence Free Minnesota was here. I'm really fortunate that I worked in a workplace as somebody where there was a multiple instances of sexual violence, and I had a job that gave me 2 weeks off of pay and then another 2 weeks off of pay later on in the year to go through ceremony for healing. My counterparts who had also experienced violence, they weren't so lucky. And also then birthed a baby at the end of the year and really could have used these benefits and not have to go into debt, not have to take on the load of credit to be able to necessitate healing. You know, we heard survivors need the time to go to medical appointments, to go to counseling. And then also we're talking about the impact onto employees' productivity and retaining them. And so that, to me, this, my question at the heart of it is, we've heard from teachers, we've heard from small businesses, we've heard from folks with medical challenges. And what is going to change in the next 10 months or that we haven't already done since it passed in 2023 that the state agencies are saying we're ready, we're on track for implementation, businesses, small businesses are ready, Minnesotans are ready. What's going to change?
Representative Baker.
I think what's going to change is we need to make sure that the employees and the employers, you got to look at the employers too. You can't ignore the employer. they need to be understanding what is coming at them. Right now, ESST came out in January of 2024. And do you know, 2023, not sure, when did it, January 24?
Yes.
There's many of them that are just finding out about that today. And in, for different reasons, they don't know anything about it. I'm not convinced. Deed knows how to communicate with employees to this level, to the employers to this level, to make sure that they're ready. I haven't seen a presentation. I haven't heard anything from the department. Maybe they are. We haven't heard it yet. I guess I'm going to just demand that if we can be convinced that this is ready to roll out, there's a lot more information that I need today to make sure that we're ready, because just because you say we're ready doesn't mean that the whole group, and this is what the big part of this whole legislative process is, it's slow, it's methodical, we have to do a lot of conversations, but this is the largest, you know, business mandate that's put forward for some good reasons. Again, I'm not here to talk about repealing. I don't think this is a watering anything down. It's providing something that we can get to that everybody and more people can get behind. The more people that get behind this, the more successful this will be. So I hope that, again, my DFL colleagues will be open to continuing this conversation about what can we do to make sure that we're all ready for this. Today, I'm not convinced. I'm just one, but I hope we get there. Thank you.
Representative Kozlowski, are you anything else? Nope. Next, we have Representative Hussein.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. This is very personal to me, this bill. About 13 years ago, my mom was struggling and dying cancer in bed. And we did not have this program. I did not have any opportunity. I was the only one who was making a bread for the family. I had to take her all the way to Mayo Clinic for treatment and chemotherapy and bring her back in St. Paul back and forth. I could not continue. I didn't have no job opportunity, job, no protections. So I lost for my mom and my job. So imagine how many people are waiting for this program to kind of utilize it for those two half weeks or whatever opportunity that we can spend our loved ones that we care about, that we want to make sure that we spend for the last moment in their life. I did not have that opportunity. I had to juggle back work and spending time with my mom, who was really sick by the time. And that's the time that she really, really, really needed me to be there. And when Bill this came forward, yes, last year, I was excited. I spoke in front of the committees and supported 100%. Delaying this will cost hurtful for many Minnesotans, including people that wanted to spend a time with their life once. And that's why I wanted to share this very emotional and tough to me to come and forward in front of these committees. We have many people like me struggling right now that are waiting for on front of the line just to make sure that they can get this opportunity that we passed a year ago, delaying this. And we seen so many testimonies who came forward in front of us and share. We could do better. The European, the other countries that is very poor, even in Africa, are giving people opportunity to spend with their loved one when they're dying. We're living in a great nation. We're living in the state of Minnesota. It's better. We could do better. Stop delaying this, and we need to get along and move forward and do what's right for our people. Chair Baker, I have a question that I would love to ask you. How will this delay impact businesses, workers, families who have been expecting this use pay family leave starting 2026 or even sooner? What would you say to those people?
Representative Baker.
And I have two more follow-up questions.
Thank you. I would say how we answer that is we can't let something out if it's not ready to go. We made that mistake in different IT programs in Minnesota, Representative Hussein. Again, we're going to keep hearing about the Minlars disaster, but it went out sooner than it was ready. Even then, it was delayed several years before they wanted to launch it out. This is as complex, as large, because it affects every single employer in the state of Minnesota. Like Minlars affected every single vehicle and every single registration, every single sale. Now we can say, well, this is people and not automobile, but it's the same kind of a system. If the system breaks down and we have family planning to go on family leave starting in January, February of 26, and we aren't ready, we shouldn't go out then, because they're going to go out on work and we're not going to give them, they're not going to have any money. That's a serious problem. So I just want to say that we have to tell them that we've got to get it right. I can't, my thoughts are we should make sure that we all agree that it's ready to go. And if we don't all agree that today, my point today is elections had a change in the direction of what we could ask in these questions and in these hearings. I want to make sure we get that other half talked about more clearly, so when it does go out, we get it right. And that's what I just want to keep harping on. It's got to work, and I'm not convinced it'll work today. So to those people, I'm sorry, it might be delayed. It may not be, but it might be, because we don't want to make it harder for you if it goes out and it's a disaster. I don't want to be sitting here with families that are screaming at us in next January or February, March, I haven't been paid. What's going on? And that's what was happening before, when IT systems just lock everything up. I've seen it too many times.
Representative Hussein.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. I appreciate it for relating to IT, but this is a life and death. These people could have an opportunity to spend with their loved ones, and we are delaying. Who are they going to challenge later on and regret the rest of their life? It's us as the legislators. That's why we should not be delaying, because I had that experience in the past. I could spend more time if this kind of program availability is here 13 years ago, which wasn't. What feedback have you received from stakeholders, including employees, labor group, and state agencies about this delay? Have you consulted with DEED and other agencies? Because a lot of people have came testified and they're saying, it's enough, it's enough. We can't be having more delay. We need to move forward.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, what I've heard the last, again, it could be last couple of years, but even more recently, I think is what you're talking about. Again, we talked about the fiscal note a lot in our Tuesday hearing. I still don't have fiscal notes that I asked for a year ago. I don't know what certain things are going to cost if we tried to find exceptions, or if we found some ways of trying to modify the program a little bit. I was ignored. The business community as a whole was ignored in the last 2 years. School districts are coming to us saying, now that we see this, we're not sure this is right for us, because what we heard in testimony before we officially were called into action is that school districts, for example, are saying, we don't know where this money is going to come from, because it comes from our taxes, and they don't have the ability to just raise taxes like county boards do. So they're worried this is going to hurt students and they're going to hurt teachers. So I think we've got to make sure that we get all of those voices here. When this thing was 2 years ago, I had a number of different unions come to my office, laborers, and I asked them about this idea, because I kind of knew where it was going to go. I will tell you, at least 6 to 8 union groups, when I would ask them about, what do you think about this? Every single one of those groups that met with me said, we didn't ask for this. This isn't our collective bargaining plan. This wasn't part of what we're doing. That's what they said initially. I'm not saying that's their voices today. I'm saying, though, when it first came out, like in Representative Johnson's case, they have some very good, robust programs now going on. So they had been negotiating those over many, many years. They're asking us today, if you listen to your school districts, that's what exactly what they're going to tell you. So I want to make sure that we're asking the right questions to our own districts. That's who we represent. So I beg you, I beg all of us to talk to those people. Are we ready? Do you know how you're going to pay for this? And again, just going back to the IT is not people. You're right. But we aren't going to be handwriting out checks from the state of Minnesota when their system isn't functioning. And so it comes down to the reality of we have to find a system that can work and support our families. We're going to be taking $1.5 billion in tax collections from Minnesotans starting in 26, $1.5 billion, roughly half from employees and half from employers. We need to make sure that that system is robustly set up. I haven't seen any evidence that that's going to happen. Now, I'm looking forward to our meeting in Ways and Means next week. I think we're going to have more talking about the fiscal note as well, not about this bill, but I think we're going to talk about more about the fiscal note too there. So, Representative Hussein, I hope that it's deeper than caring. We care. I care. I just don't want to hurt people because we didn't have it right, because I've seen it here before. We have messed it up before.
Representative Hussein.
Thank you for your answer, but I feel like we haven't addressed yet for the concern, how do we address our constituents, your constituents, who's emailing to me and saying we are 100% sure this bill has been passed and we've been waiting for now we can plan to have a baby, or now we can have, you know, our sick ones, we can take care of it, we can, you know, get away opportunities. How do we address for those people, our constituents and the people that advocated for this and supported for 100% for this bill in the past?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hussein, I think you got to tell them what I'm telling them. We're working really hard together to getting this to work out. Stand by. We're working really hard to make sure this is right. That's what I would tell your constituent. That's what I'm telling my constituents, too, that are ready to have a baby. We need to get this right. That's what I would suggest you tell them.
And Representative Hussein. One last question. Thank you. Have you ever consulted or reached out to the bill author for the bill that has been passed?
Representative Baker.
Representative Richardson, in the past, we talked about many times. I shouldn't say many times. She didn't take a lot of meetings with people that were sort of on my side of the aisle wanting to talk about challenges that we were facing. Representative Frazier took on the bill, and he and I have met a few different times on this. But last year was a pass it, get it done. It doesn't matter how it's going to work. I had members on your side say, we'll fix it as it goes. I don't work that way. At least when I carry a bill, I want to make sure it's right. When my friend Liz Olson and I passed the opioid bill, there was so much work and so many details, and we got it right on the front end. I feel like this is my next big bipartisan, very large bill that we've got to get right, or it's not going to work. So I need support on both sides, but we have to make sure we talk openly. And I'm looking for my meetings with Representative Frazier, Representative Pinto, and others, because it's going to take that to make sure that we get back here with maybe some other ideas. I am not stopping with this on this idea, on this bill, with just this. We have a lot more discussions to do. So thank you for the questioning.
Representative Hussein.
I just want to thank you, and this is very personal to me, and there's so many people are struggling out there. I don't want them to go through what I have went through, and that's the reason I ask all those questions, and I appreciate it. We could have, like, if you had a concern or something, we could have go back and, you know, like, we'll work with the bill author in the state delaying for another 2 years, so you're behind. That would... I want to thank you.
Next on the list is Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of thoughts, but I'm going to start with, first of all, To my colleague, Representative Hussein, thank you for sharing that about your mom. And I don't see any of our testifiers really from this morning left in the room, but those were some heart-wrenching stories. And I think sometimes when we're here and we're battling it out over minutiae and details and language, all of that's important, but we tend to forget that legislation is about people. And we heard those stories today. One of the stories I'd like to share is I was door knocking this summer, and I knocked on the door, and a single mom answered the door, and we were chatting for a little bit. She wasn't very politically involved, and apparently I'd never knocked her door before, so it was a first for both of us. And she was I was sharing some things that we had done last session, just to kind of bring her up to speed, and the look on her face when I talked about paid family medical leave, she just lit up. And she shared with me that she's a single mom. I think she had three children. And she has one child that has either severe asthma or some other breathing complications. And she had to rush that child to the hospital one day. And she had to stay in the hospital with that child. And then she had to care for the child after the hospital stay. And then she lost her job. So now she's a single mom with mounting medical debt, trying to figure out how to feed, house, clothe her children, keep them in school, keep everything going, all of the balls in the air after she lost her job to care for her child. And think about that sentence, that we are asking people to choose between their child or their job, which helps them care for their child. That is a sentence that in any language, in any country in this world, should never have to be said. We don't choose between our children and the ability to financially care for our children and their families. And I am pleased to say that she rose up out of that and she was in school. I think she was completing her master's when I spoke with her, but the idea that she could have had a chance to care for her child and keep her job literally never occurred to her. And so hearing that that program was out there, and I made sure I told her it's not implemented yet because this child is going to have complications for life. So this is going to arise again. It's just, when does it arise? And at that next time that it arises, is she covered? Right? And so I've never worked with you before. I'm enjoying the committee thus far. I do have to say I'm suspect that our colleagues on your side of the aisle want to delay this, because we know at every single turn in all of the discussions, whether it was the author was Representative Richardson or whether it was Representative Frazier, you found absolutely every possible way to drain the humanity out of this issue and block it at every turn. And so I apologize if I'm a little suspect that this isn't just the first step to getting rid of this altogether. And so I guess my question for you is, what are some of the specific logistical or financial obstacles to this that you have specifically made a list of? These are the issues that renders this need to delay this.
Members, just a friendly reminder, we're not impugning motives of other members, but Representative Baker.
I guess what I'm trying to get to, Representative Berg, is to make sure that all the voices are heard. As we start, for me at a super high level, I just want to make sure that Minnesota can compete on an economic level. Around our state, they are kicking our butts when it comes to job growth, with economic vitality is better around us than it is in Minnesota. And that shouldn't be that way. I'm a competitive guy. I have a big heart for my employees. If you asked any one of my employees, they will tell you that. But I'm telling you what I hope that our relationship will grow and the trust will be there, and I hope that all happens. Because when I saw you on the committee, I'm like, all right, here we got a spunky one. This is going to work out great. Because I have watched you and you do a wonderful job. But I'm saying this because the voices that were here this morning too, that were concerned about the bill, I also think we're representing a lot of people that really care about their employees. Economically, we want to make sure that we can compete. This is a mandate that will be put on businesses either by 50% or 100%. It's their choice, whatever. But if they do this, they have to compete. And that's the bottom line of how they actually pay all of their benefits, not just this one. But some of them, again, as I have said in this committee many times, I just don't want the state of Minnesota writing my handbook because my employees can go somewhere else if I can't give them the benefits that they need. Now, I am not asking for a repeal. I'm asking for a pause. And I am committed to working on this bill, this issue, and I hope that this session, and I hope that this committee will show the rest of all of our colleagues in the Minnesota House how we get things done, how we can actually come up with some really good ideas that still touch everybody in a positive way that's more positive today than they had yesterday. So I really hope that we can find that energy, that collaborative manner. But I have to say we have to still be competitive, that we don't have a choice. I want to make sure our businesses are not put at a big disadvantage. And again, it's all part of the mix. It's all part of this balance. So I hope that some of that made some sense.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. Certainly, I apologize. I don't want to impugn motives of anybody on the committee. I think it's fairly factual to say that this was not a bill that was supported by the other side of the aisle. However, I do agree with you on being collaborative. In fact, I just signed on to one of your bills, Representative Schultz. I know that is shocking because I'm your favorite, but I did right before session. So I appreciate your answer. I really do. And I do believe you want this to be rolled out and to get it right for both the employers and the employees. And if we have that in our hearts, I think we can do this. Just to clarify, though, there aren't any actual examples that you can point to that are impediments that you've heard from employers or agencies at this point.
Well,
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would say what I've heard is from many, many businesses, first of all, my little business can't afford this because they will have people out of the workforce longer than normal. People are having babies today. They're out of the workforce having babies today and other medical things too. But they're worried as a small business. They are barely covering their retail shops, whatever business that they're in, they literally don't know that they can take another 10% of those hours away for an extended period of time. I've heard from school districts that are screaming for help because they don't know what to do because this is a big mandate, unfunded, and they really feel good about what they've given their employees to date. So we're just... I want to make sure we talk about those sectors out there. It's not a one-size-fits-all. If there's a theme that I can say to this whole bill, Representative Berg, this one-size-fits-all is the biggest problem with what you passed last year. A one-size-fits-all in Minnesota for this large of a program should have some reasonable exceptions for different groups, for different industries. I want to talk about a seasonal adjustment, maybe a business that's open for 150 to 180 days. Those other states do that. Most states do that. I think this is the only state in the country that is offering a plan that goes all the way down to every single employer with one employee. Others have exempted 5 or 10. So I've done a lot of work around the country to see what is working around the country. And I'm bringing it here to say, we have the most progressive plan, but what I heard from the DFL was, but everybody deserves that benefit. I agree. I think that makes sense. We have to find a way to do it, but it doesn't have to be a one-size-fits-all.
Representative Berg.
Thanks.
Very good. Next on the list is Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. I know how engaged you've been in this conversation in the last couple years, and just to sort of talk a little bit about the timeline, because I've heard you say, you know, in the last 2 years that that employers weren't listened to, businesses weren't listened to, and just to note that people have been working on this bill for a long, long time, not just the last 2 years, and the fact that it only passed in 2023 is a sign, I think, that the legislature was listening to those opponents, particularly the biggest opponents, for a long time. And so I don't think it's fair to say that either the issues raised or the objections, the experiences of those employers who oppose it, because we also heard from employers who support it, weren't included. And so just to say that, because I think it's important, this did not come out of nowhere. I think a testifier said that. We passed it in 2023. It's now 2025. It's not set to go into effect for another 10 months. And you talked a little bit about the benefits to best fit the employer, but I think what we're trying to figure out is what do Minnesotans need? And that includes employers, but it absolutely, I think, includes and centers families and communities. And I know you know that. And, you know, 70, I think the last poll I saw, but this is, it's been pretty consistent, I think, in the last decade or two, like 77% of employees in 2024 said that they wanted this benefit. 79% of small businesses wanted a federal program. It'd be great if we had a federal program. I think in many cases here in Minnesota, what we're doing is making up for that lack of leadership at the federal level and sort of trying to catch up with the 12 or 13 other states that are already doing it. It's not lost on me as we listen to the testifiers that the two real voices that came out were the workers and the small businesses. And they're both, and I think what we heard, and this is the sort of jurisdiction of this committee, both workers and the small businesses that are getting squeezed in an economy that feels very tilted to the biggest companies, the monopolies, whether it's the supply chain, whether it's the Walmarts and the Amazons. And that is a problem here, too. Because as we think about the percentage of the people who are employed by small businesses, it used to be, I pulled the numbers, 43% in 1978, now 32%, maybe declining. I think, like, I've heard that state, right? We have a lot of people who work for big businesses now. And one of the reasons we heard is because they can offer things like paid family medical leave that small businesses can't offer. So from a competitive perspective, and I know we share the value of we should and need to be doing more for our small businesses, our local businesses, the folks in our community, right, that have 10, 20, 30 employees. And I think we oftentimes have a trickle-down business agenda, which a lot goes to the top and not very much goes to the bottom. We think about small businesses. And so in this moment, I think it's important to ask that question. But in the spirit of sort of a collaborative, what problem we're trying to solve, it seems to me that, and I'm wondering if you have any ideas, like we have 10 months. We have, this was passed in 2023. There was Representative Frazier and Bell was in 2024. There, we have this whole session, and we have 10 months. And so are there things that you, as we think about those small businesses, particularly the ones we heard from, who are saying we want it to go into effect, are there other things we could be doing to support the small businesses and the issues they're raising that we could be doing in the next 10 months?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker.
Thank you for the question. I think there are things we can do. But here's what I see our timeline is left. We have literally 2 months left here to do any changes because we burned up a month. We're in our first full week of hearings, but we're in the middle of February. Happy Valentine's week, everybody. So I don't feel we have the time to fix anything. If we get out of here on time, we aren't fixing anything. Because you heard Deed come back from all these summer hearings and summer listening sessions. They heard numerous times from communities that one size fits all, I'm really, really concerned about that. Can you come up with anything else? And you heard them in testimony say they're coming back here to offer nothing for improvements to this bill. Nothing. Also, I want to address the point that you made, Representative Greenman, about it's a very popular program. It is. But if you ask those people, do they know they're going to be paying for this? Most of them do not, because when I ask them that, they don't have a clue, because headlines look like a paid family medical plan. It's a beautiful word. It's beautiful. But it is not. When you also then tell them that there's a cost to this, then a lot of them will say, oh, well, what do you mean? I'm not saying that they're not willing to pay for something, but just understand when you ask them in a poll, do they really understand what's all coming? We need to ask that question fairly to all of us, because I don't know that they do that at this point. So many businesses are hearing the headlines that are worried about this one size fits all on the same stretch. Employees don't have a clue that there's going to be a payroll tax coming in 2026.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. I think, in having worked on some bills in this committee where a lot of, particularly from the biggest business associations, a lot of the concerns and questions are things that are asked over and over and over again, have been asked in, and sometimes there's just a disagreement. Right? And there's a disagreement in how it's supposed to work. And there was a policy decision that was made in 2023 and 2024. I think the policy decisions that the idea that it shouldn't matter what size of business you work in, whether you get a benefit or not. I mean, that's sort of the piece of, you can say one size fits all, but it also means that if you're a Minnesotan, you can go work at a business that has four employees and get the same benefit as if you go work at 3M or Medtronic. And I want that. I want people to go work in the local businesses in my community. I think when I think about and you talked a little bit about the 2024 election, but what I knocked on a lot of doors, and what I know I never heard, was people want less support and they want it to take longer. And so at this point, people have been waiting. The 2026 implementation date was, I think, longer than most people who are working on the bill, most allies. I think it was a negotiated 1 year later. And now we're talking about delaying it again. And when I think about what people want and expect from us, right? It should be to get to keep the timelines. And I think that, I mean, I think we'll probably hear from Deed. I hope we hear from Deed, because we talked a lot about Deed and this program, but actually haven't heard directly from Deed. But what I'm hearing from Deed is they are ready to implement. What I am hearing, when what I'm interested in, is if there are issues about supporting small businesses. You know, we have, I think, you know, $300 million a year in the R&D tax credit that goes to the biggest businesses, $110 million a year at this point that goes to, in the data center tax breaks, that goes to the biggest corporations. I would love to talk about, if we're talking about our struggling small businesses and being able to afford that payroll tax, that we talk about the businesses that are 10 and 20 in all of our districts that are getting squeezed. I would love to talk about how we support them and how we maybe redistribute up. Or redistribute down so that those small businesses. That, to me, is a conversation we can have in 2 months. Delaying it, and I think delaying what we heard, both people's expectations, also what I feel like the people expect right now, I just think is a bad idea. And so I'm looking forward to the conversations about how we can small businesses, but I'm going to vote no on this.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker, for allowing us to have this conversation. I think, you know, one of the things I am kind of surprised, you and I have talked before, we talked last year when I picked this bill up, and I am kind of surprised that I didn't see a solution-oriented bill versus a delay bill, because I just expected that from you, because I do believe you are being sincere when you say you want to make this work. So I am surprised I didn't see that, but it's not too late. It is not too late. I know we're in February, but I still believe we have time to get something done. In fact, I've been talking to folks, some of the folks that work with and represent some of the people that testified in support of your delay bill, they believe that they can bring something to work something out to get this done. And I know you're talking to those same folks, but I just wanted to say I'm surprised that we didn't see that now as opposed to this delay bill, because the delay bill doesn't encourage me in terms of getting to a solution where we're going to put this in place. I mean, you heard folks testify that they're concerned that this delay tactic is only to actually destroy this program and never allow it to get off the ground. And that's, I hear that deeply. And I know that when this, as we work toward passing this law, the reason we had to delay, the reason we didn't start sooner than this was because we were listening to those folks that were opponents of this. And I do just want to make sure that when we talk about not being heard, being heard and listened to isn't the same as agreeing on something. And because we didn't come to agreements on everything that's in the bill, it doesn't mean that those folks weren't heard. It doesn't mean there wasn't deliberate thought put into everything that they suggested to be in this bill. Because I was in some of those conversations, a lot of them last year, and I know there was. We looked at ways to change the bill based on what individuals thought, or what some of the corporations thought, or what some of the counties and the school districts thought. So I know those conversations were happening, and they were done in a thoughtful way. But again, just because we didn't come to agreement, it doesn't mean that they weren't heard. In fact, much of what I heard today was similar to what I've heard over the multiple years we took to get this bill passed. I didn't hear anything different that came from those organizations or the representatives of those organizations that talked. And that, to me, says that it's not that you don't understand this bill. It's not that you it's what it is to me is that not that you don't understand the bill, but you just still don't like this. You don't like this law, and you don't want this law to go into effect. And I hope that as we work the next couple of months, that we actually have people come forward with actual real concerns that we can put into a bill to work on solutions. Right? Right now, as this law stands, and I do want to call, Mr. Chair, I do want to call Deed up to allow them to speak if that's possible.
Yeah, that would be fine. I'm sorry. Who was your? Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So I was going to say, I'll stop right there because I just want Deed to give a chance to speak, because we have talked a lot about Deed, but we haven't had the chance to have Deed come up and respond to a lot of this thing. And they have been in a room hearing to what was testified to, and I do want to give them the opportunity to speak.
If you can just state your name for the record and proceed.
Good evening, members. My name is Devin Bowdry, Government Relations Director at Deed. You know, our position is that we are ready to go January of 2026, and we have what we need.
Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Bowdry, can you just give us a kind of a recap or summary of the outreach that has been done up to now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, yeah, we have done quite a bit of outreach. First, back in 2023, 2024, starting with just initial meetings with some of the testifiers that you heard from this morning, the chamber, NFIB, hospitality, Mayo Clinic, just to start with employers. So our initial outreach right now is employer focused. After that, we went into a rulemaking period. And during that open rulemaking period, we heard we held 19 virtual listening sessions that had close to 1,000 individual attendees, and we received 600 written comments. So tons of feedback through that mechanism. Then we did the Greater Minnesota Roadshow in the summer and fall of 2024, and that was 18 engagement sessions with employers across the state in Greater Minnesota. We had 1,300 employees, with the highest attendance being in Wilmer, Mr. Chair.
Ta-da!
and continuing to do that, and I know the Metro lawmakers are probably like, Greater Minnesota Roadshow, you know, spring, we got something coming, stay tuned. We'll be doing a spring roadshow as well. We've worked with and collaborated with the various school employers, 343 employers that represent various school districts. And additionally, we've done, a number of virtual webinars. We did two in October of 24 that had 2,900 attendees. And we did one just yesterday, actually, which had 2,400 attendees as well. So that's kind of where we're starting. We have an engagement team, and they have just launched a live link where you can request that people come to your events, your festivals, your chambers to speak about paid leave, and the latest updates, and we know we need to circle back to Greater Minnesota as well, because some of the information was new, there were questions that were unanswered, and we want to get to those questions. And additionally, we are working to leverage the teams within DEED that have been there for a long time, that engage with employers on a frequent basis and have those long-standing relationships, and so working to leverage outreach as much as we can. And I guess lastly, the thing to expect for the summer is the community outreach grants that are part of paid leave. Those will start up in July. So that's nonprofits getting in the mix as well to help do outreach and engagement with various employer groups.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Baldwin. That sounds pretty robust. I appreciate you sharing that information with us. You know, well, you were in the room this morning when we were having testimony, and there's just a couple of things that stood out to me during one of the particular testimonies in regards to just how this program will work once it goes into effect. And one of the questions, if you could just answer, one of the questions was, there was someone that had some confusion around whether or not an individual could be in the process of receiving unemployment insurance and also simultaneously in the process of receiving paid leave. Could that happen?
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, no. So in UI, and not to get too deep into the weeds of UI, but there is a requirement that you are ready to work, you are looking for suitable employment, whereas paid leave is doing just the opposite of that. You're telling us that you are sick or you're taking care of a sick family member, you cannot work. So that would go directly counter to UI, and you would be ineligible.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer, for clarifying that. One of the other questions, or seemed to be some vagueness around how the law works, was can an individual, once the individual qualifies and then DEED determines qualification is there and they begin to make the payouts. Now, we know that the way this law works, it isn't the 100% of your wages. It is a percentage of your wages, and it will vary depending on what your wages are. Will that individual, when I heard in testimony was that then the employer would be required to pay the difference in those wages. The way the law is written, is that correct?
Mr. Broderick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, no. I believe an employer could elect, if they choose, to kind of top off and max out an employer's wage that they would otherwise get, but otherwise, no, they would not be paying additional.
Representative
Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for clarifying that. That's what I thought. Can you, and this has not, we have not requested this of DEED, and I think that's all something that surprises me too. Would DEED be willing to come back to this committee and do a total walkthrough of how this bill works, but also, if possible, do a demonstration around the IT pieces? Because there seems to be some concern based on our history with Menlars, and I would like to think that we've learned our lessons, and we're better off now, and we know to prepare for those things. But would DEED be willing to come back into this committee to do a presentation for folks so they can truly understand and see the process and where DEED is in that process with the IT part?
Mr. Boundary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, yeah, we could certainly come in and do that. You know, we have right now a presentation ready in anticipation that we'd be asked to do a fuller implementation update. I'm not entirely sure yet where we are as far as like demos and clicking around an IT system, but we have an IT vendor, one that is experienced, and their whole model is based around working with governments and helping to stand up systems like this. So we could get into that.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll be looking forward to that, for you to come back to do that. Thank you for your time.
Hang on. I'm going to ask him some questions too while you write them up. So do you have any more?
No, go ahead.
Okay, just a quick question. Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I just want to, again,
Representative Baker.
I appreciate the department being here too, and we have an open dialogue with the department. So by not having them here, wasn't trying to circumvent the agency that's going to run the thing. We just have more time to do this in the next few weeks because I am going to be asking questions, and we need to understand, and this is a question for Mr. Devin. My question is, you know, have we hired a third party to come in and test the IT system? Do you have a third party, or are you just going with the person you've hired?
Devin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, first off, yeah, I appreciate working together, and you've been very communicative, and we have a good relationship so far. And but no, I guess I'm not sure yet about the third-party IT testing. During our roadshow, actually, though, we did get a lot of employers signing up to volunteer to be user testers, which we thought was a nice way to leverage those events. But I'd have to get back to you on third party.
And again, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sensitive to tonight's just longevity here. I don't want to go too long. But there are questions about how many businesses have really been in contact with the department. You've had these road shows, but how many registered businesses are in Minnesota?
Mr. Bowdrey.
And to follow up, how many have we communicated with on this massive program?
Mr. Bowdrey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, how many registered businesses in Minnesota? I'm not sure. I'd have to check either with Secretary of State or one of our teams back at Deed. And how many have formally engaged with a paid leave, you know, webinar or so on? I mean, I went into the kind of thousands that we have reached through these events that we've hosted, but how many then hear about it through other means? I'm not sure.
Representative Baker.
And just final, again, there's a lot of industries out there that are begging to make sure that you hear them as an industry too, like nursing homes. Hospitals are worried about the ratio complexities that they're going to have, and if they're folks that are out of work further and more are going to affect their patient care. I think there's just a lot more people, a lot more businesses that want to know around my industry, how does this work? So again, we will have further conversations down the road with the department, and we'll have a full-blown thing. We'll talk a lot more about IT down the road too, so that'll be very helpful. So thank you. Thank you for letting me do that.
Next on the list, we have Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Baker, and particularly thanks to Rep. Frazier for leading on this issue, and former Rep. Richardson. I hope that she's not taking her time to watch us tonight, but in case she is, I'm really grateful to her for her leadership on this.
Representative Pinto, can I just say one thing? I forgot to kind of reply to one thing that Representative Frazier had, because you had said, why didn't you bring these other ideas to us before?
Yes,
and I did. I brought a paid family. It was a private version of a min family on the House floor. I was looking for versions of let's carve out 10 and under employees, 20 and under employees. I wanted to know what that was like. I had bills in the hopper that never saw the committee because the chair didn't take those on. I asked for hearings many times. I also asked for fiscal notes, as you heard earlier. I asked for fiscal notes because I wanted to know, if I bring an idea to the table, is this workable? I never got a fiscal return from the department. So I do want to tell you, Representative Frazier, as the author of this, you have been much more accessible than the prior author. Thank you. I have been trying to give ideas into this for the last 2 years, and now I have a little better chance. I just wanted to follow up on that, so they will continue. And I'm sorry for that, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinnell, thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, can I...
Of course.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And I do know that you were trying in those efforts. I was speaking to this moment now that you have the gavel. You could have brought the bill with those particular things and concerns to get them heard. That's what I was referring to. But I do know you were trying to, you were working on those pieces. So I appreciate you saying that. And I do want to say, I know one of the things, and I'm going to just finish with this and I'll stop. But I mean, we've heard constantly that this is a one size fits all bill. When in fact, there are some things and there are some exceptions within the bill. Thank you, Devin. There are some exceptions. I mean, you have employers are allowed to substitute if they have a plan that is better than or that is the same or better than, they can be exempt from this program. That is allowable for everyone in the program. There are exemptions for seasonal employees. That was one of the things that was taken in, right? There is exemptions for independent contractors, the self-employed folks. That is one of the things that is there. And small employers will pay a lower premium, and there are also grants as well to help those small employers out. So there are things within this thing, and I think we need to get away. There's more nuance than one size fits all, because there are exceptions that provided within the law, and those are absolutely there because of the conversations that were had throughout the process with stakeholders before this bill was passed. So I just want to make sure that it's on the record and clear, because I often don't hear, I've heard no one that testified against this bill talk about those exemptions and those things that were listed in the bill. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Baker. I've got a couple, got some questions and comments, and then there'll be some motions we make, and I mentioned to Chair Baker in advance that would be happening. I'm going to start just with a question, Mr. Chair, about Chair Baker, about something that you said in response to a question. I think it might have been Representative Hussein's question, but you had said, I think about the program with this bill, it might be delayed, it might not, was kind of what I heard you say. And it seemed like maybe that fit with some of the other things you've said since, but could you just explain what you meant by that? I was trying to understand that.
Representative Baker.
Well, Mr. Chair and Lead Pinto, I think what I want to do is, again, when you have committee hearings and you introduce bills, you bring bills or ideas to a, you know, possibly making things better, making things cheaper, making things whatever. This bill today is saying, I just want to make sure that we have the ability to pause something if we don't all feel like this is ready to go. So what this might do is we might come to some really awakening, beautiful collaborations on something that we can get out the door in 26. But we've got to make sure that we get the business community to support something, the school districts to support this. Because, again, if any of us have talked to school districts, they are not – after the sort of the dust has settled after the 23-24 sessions, they are not sure how to implement this. Not from a want to give it, but they don't have the dollars to do it. So my point is, Representative Pinto, this is an idea that we want to make sure that when we get it to the floor, we can talk about more things. It's just one of our avenues that we may want to use, because if we don't feel it's ready to go, then we can say we've talked a lot about this. Delay, but we also have other ideas coming.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chair Baker, I guess I'm a little confused. So are you saying then that this is something that that sort of if the program is not ready to go January 1st, 2026, this could happen, that this delay could happen? I guess I'm confused. Like, are you talking about how there could be a potential further delay, or are you saying potentially this actually wouldn't end up being a good idea?
Representative Baker.
I think, Mr. Chair, what I want to make sure is that we all feel like they are ready with the IT, that they're all ready with the business answers that they've been trying to get to. There's a lot of businesses that are not getting clear answers for who's eligible and who's not. There's a lot of unanswered questions. So I want to make sure that this is our ability to slow the program, to pause it for a minute, to make sure that we get all those answers before it goes out the door.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Chair Baker. Chair Baker, you heard the stakes and you heard the experiences. And may I say, adding to the words of my colleagues, how grateful I am for the just powerful words, powerful stories folks shared. And I saw your expressions as you were listening, and I know you, and know that, you know, I know that your heart was moved in listening, as so many of ours. And these are folks saying, like, I need this now, right? And what your bill would do if we vote yes, if that bill were to become law, is that it would cause people to wait for a year. And I would think you would agree that there should be a very high standard given the expectations, given the moral weight of those stories that we heard. So we should only delay this if there is absolute, if it's absolutely necessary. If there's absolute, and I'm an attorney thinking about evidence, if there's absolute evidence of doing so. And Mr. Chair, I'm just unclear. You talked about various things from businesses. What I mostly heard in the testimony today was concerns about paid family medical leave, about having it just not happen at all. I heard some vague concerns about implementation. The testimony we received from Deed, and it was said, it was Representative Frazier who brought them up, is that this program is in fact ready to go. If there's evidence that the program is not ready to go and you control the agenda, Mr. Chair, you could have a hearing where they could be questioned. You could prove that. And so I guess I'm just unclear that I don't see that proof has been met. And in recognition of those experiences that people shared with us, exactly how are we going to use those 365 days? What exactly is the promise that it won't become 366 or 700 days or 1,000 days? Like, and I would say I don't think, Mr. Chair, that it can be a general response. Well, I think we sort of need some time. People are desperate now. So if there was testimony saying that Deed has a, you know, there's an IT system that is necessary, we explain why it's necessary, and it's not going to be online until May of 2026. Okay, that's concrete. Let's talk about that, right? I will tell you, I heard nothing anywhere in the same universe as that. So is there something you can share, Mr. Chair, that is concrete enough to respond to the pain that we heard from people and the desperation they feel?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, the testimony is always moving to me. It is heartbreaking because there's some really desperate situations out there that sometimes, you know, government programs just don't always just snap their fingers and it works. What I'm trying to fight for, as I said earlier, it's the part of the program that wasn't heard, and that's the people that have to be required to provide a job. Without jobs, this doesn't work. You got to have a job in order to have this benefit. If we don't have employers in the state of Minnesota, and if they're pushed out of the state of Minnesota, my point is the economics of this. It has to pencil out. You know, this is a very robust program. Should it be 12 weeks, 20 weeks, 80 weeks, whatever? I don't know where we came up with a number, but we have to make sure that whatever number that is, it has to stand up. It has to be supported by businesses that can, number one, provide a job for someone to have paid family, because if you don't have a job, you're not part of the program. So we've got to make sure that we don't forget about the business side of this equation to make sure that they also are robust enough and ready for this and communicated enough to this to be ready for this to launch on January of 2026, much better than we did with the ESST rollout for businesses in 2024. That has to be much improved. So my concern is the stories are real, but the businesses also have to be there financially to make sure that they're there when they have them employed in the first place and when they're ready to return. So that's what I'm fighting for, is the balance of this bill, the balance of this idea has to be examined and carefully crafted to make sure it works.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Baker. Do you have a plan to use the 365 days to meet the concerns that you've addressed? And if so, what is that plan?
Mr. Chair, I think my plan is to get through this hearing. We're going to move this bill off the floor, and then you're going to see probably some other ideas that we're going to be presenting that we're still working on. Quite frankly, there's a lot of things going on. I have, now that I've learned after the last session, what does it look like? I didn't know how much this was going to affect school districts. I didn't know how much this was going to affect smaller businesses in the last 6, 8, 9, 10 months. I've learned a lot by listening to people that went to the Deed meetings in the summer. So I've learned a lot in the last 6, 8 months that is actually evolving me to say, oh, yeah, we've got a bigger problem now than ever. So my specific answers are coming soon to a theater near you, Representative Pinto, because this has got to be something that we're going to be working on a lot this year.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Baker. Well, Chair Baker, a vote on this bill is coming a lot sooner than that, right? It's coming in the next few minutes. Mm-hmm. And you are asking the members of this committee, Mr. Chair, to decide whether or not you complain that there's about one size fits all being the biggest problem here, and your proposal is to take the program exactly as is and just make people wait another year for it, and there's no plan to do anything with that. And I want to ask, Mr. Chair, I know that a fiscal note was requested for this. My understanding has not arrived yet. Maybe just I see you nodding, so there is no fiscal note. My understanding is that this will come out of multiple budgets. Maybe I'll ask this at this point, Mr. Chair. 2 years ago, the minority lead on the Jobs Committee made a request of the chair, expressed a concern that the paid family leave bill was being voted out of committee without a fiscal note. And that chair said that the bill would come back to the committee when a fiscal note was available. and the bill, because the bill was going to go to multiple other committees. But I'll note, by the way, this bill passed through committees in 2019 and in 2021. It passed off the floor, and then in 2023 through a variety of committees. Mr. Chair, so the minority lead of that committee 2 years ago is now the chair of this committee. And will you make the same commitment to the minority lead now that was made to you 2 years ago and was fulfilled 2 years ago, that that bill came back, that when a fiscal note is available, we will be able to be fully informed? Perhaps at that point you'll have come up with the plan that you referenced, and also that there be a fiscal note available so we'll understand the budgetary impact that is our responsibility as members of this committee.
Representative Baker.
And to that, Mr. Chair, Representative Pinot, you have my commitment to that, because okay. I told them about this bill. They've had it actually in their possession for a number of weeks, even before we, again, became official. The at that point, the deputy commissioner told me this should be a very straightforward, easy bill to do a fiscal analysis on. If you want, we can ask fiscal nonpartisan that question, because that was a comment that was made in my office along with other members like that to kind of say, what do we need? If we need a fiscal on this, they've had it. I think the fiscal note is requested, but they said it's going to be very simple. That's also one of the reasons, Representative Pinot, that we agreed with you to say it's on its way to Ways. It'll have the fiscal note by that point.
Representative Pinot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Baker. And I understand that then at that point it'll be sent back to this committee, is what I heard you say. So that our, and as has happened 2 years ago, I actually think I was wrong. I think at the time you asked that the bill be laid over until a fiscal note was available. The bill was going to go to other committees with subject matter jurisdiction, and so that's how that worked, but it did end up coming back. So my understanding from you now is once that fiscal note is available, this committee will get a chance to have the bill come back. We'll be able to review the bill at that point and make an informed decision with the fiscal note.
Representative Baker.
Representative Pinot, that was not what I said.
Okay.
I did not say that. I want to make sure I'm clear. It's going to Ways and Means. It'll have a fiscal note at that point. And at that point, I'm assuming it's going to go to the House floor. So that's what my assumption of the bill is, if I understand that.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chair Baker, so 2 years ago, you made that request. And what happened is that the bill, you asked to be laid over. The bill went to workforce development, to judiciary, to children and families, to labor, to state government, human services, finance, commerce. And then it came back to workforce development, actually went to taxes, but went to workforce development. Per your statement that the committee needed to have a fiscal note in its possession before voting the bill out. Mr. Chair, my understanding is, and maybe I'll ask this, is it still your intent to have the bill not be reviewed by committees such as Commerce, Judiciary, and Taxes that are fully within the scope of this bill?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I will take the lead on from the chairs of those committees. So far, they have not requested this. They know that it's coming. It had a lot of robust conversations the last 2 years. And the difference between this bill of a one-year delay versus standing up a huge fiscal new bill that we saw that had actuarial studies added and the old modeling of a micro-simulator model was changed to 7-day waiting periods changing midway through it, new authors coming. A fiscal note at that point is nothing compared to this right now. This is not even sure there is going to be much of a fiscal impact on this by a delay. The deed has told us it's going to be a very straightforward, easy fiscal note. I expect that soon. This, in comparison, Representative Pinot, is nothing like it was in 23 or 24 to a fiscal impact on all these other committees. So my plan is to get it to Ways and Means. And if other chairs want to hear it, they can certainly have that right to do that.
Representative Pinot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Chair Baker. Mr. Chair, I think in your role as chair, you're going to want to hear bills that have a fiscal impact on this committee. And if there's some level below which you say, hey, no problem, other folks can deal with it, they'll figure that out. What you're doing with this bill is you're taking that program and you're shifting 1 year. It is going to have an impact. And again, you got a commitment to have the bill come back to have you be able to vote as a member of this committee to be able to make a decision. And we're being asked now to do so, and not only without a fiscal note, but also on behalf of everybody else, because the bill that was heard in all those other committees is not going to be heard here. I think I'll note this, Mr. Chair Baker, you You talked about there being the need for other conversations, and you referenced that. I continue to be confused about the idea that there are sort of other ideas relating to paid leave, when what this bill does is, in fact, a one-size-fits-all solution of taking paid leave, shifting it 365 days, with a plan possibly coming later, concepts of a plan, I think we can call it, coming later on. Mr. Chair, I will tell you that in my view, this bill takes us backwards, as Representative Frazier had referenced, in terms of doing that. We have this committee is about to take a vote with no understanding of the fiscal impact of this bill. There'll be no review by the subject matter experts besides us and any of the other committees, all those other committees this bill, the paid family leave passed through. We're not going to have any of that impact at all. And no groundwork laid. There's no justification shown. Nothing concrete at all that would possibly match the comments that we heard. And Mr. Chair, you are a serious person and you're sincere, you have sincere concerns with paid leave, and I know that you do. But I will say that all overall with all this is that the message that is sent, at least that I receive, is one of unseriousness and insincerity in terms of at least the bill. And again, not about you personally, but in terms of that message from the situation that we are in. I will say to folks concerned about paid leave, there is not a 68th vote for this to have it pass off the House floor. This will not become law. It will not happen. It will not be delayed. Minnesotans are desperate. We all heard the testimony. There may well be work that we can do. Representative Frazier referenced it, and you referenced it, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to those conversations. I think that voting a bill out of this committee in these circumstances moves us backwards from that, and that, to my mind, is very unfortunate. So, Mr. Chair and Chair Meckland, we'll have a series of motions that we're going to make, and when we eventually get to it, I'll be urging members to vote no. And, Mr. Chair, then I think that the first motion is going to come from Representative Frazier. In fact, he has to do all the motions because I'm not a voting member.
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move to refer the bill to Commerce. President Pinto mentioned some of this, but this bill, actually that exemption process that I spoke about earlier, is through the Commerce Department. I'd like to move to refer the bill there because I believe it needs to be heard to know what the impact will be. So I move to refer this bill to Commerce.
To that motion, all those in favor say aye. All those opposed?
No.
Nay. The motion does not prevail. Representative Frazier again? Okay. Okay, Representative Frazier, so to that motion, all those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. That motion does not prevail. Okay. Representative Frazier, is your mic off?
Now it is.
Okay.
There you go. I'd like to refer this bill, lastly, I'd like to refer this bill to taxes. Obviously, the premiums are being paid through a payroll tax. We would like to see what the impact is there. We believe that the members on that committee and the chair should have a conversation and debate in that committee to see how this will impact this legislation.
Representative Baker, do you have something to add?
I just want to add something, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier, for this questioning. I want to let the committee know that I've had a chance to kind of review some of these things with our chairs currently. Again, I think the chairs also have the right to pull this out. Nobody has shared that with me if they want to see it in their hearing in their committee. So, again, I just want to reinforce that our chairs have the ability to do that, and at this point, no one has requested that at this point.
Thank you, Representative Baker. So to Representative Frazier's motion, to all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail.
Actually, maybe all, if I can, Mr. Chair. No.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and Representative Frazier will be the one to have to make the formal motion, but I just wanted to kind of lay the groundwork for it. I had described the desire to have the bill come back, had, I think, impliedly requested in that it be that the chair choose to lay the bill on the table. I think I kind of understand from our back and forth that's not going to happen. And so I'll be asking Representative Frazier in just a second to move to lay the bill on the table for all the reasons given. This is not a bill that is ready for us to take a vote. It is extremely not ready. We don't know the cost. It's not being sent to the right places, but ultimately we need to understand the details of the bill. And so I would ask that be the case, and I believe Representative Frazier will be requesting a roll call as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, I'll make the motion to lay this bill on the table, and I'll request a roll call.
Mr. Chair, I just want to, again, make a comment, if I could, before we take the roll.
Representative Baker.
Thank you very much. I think, again, part of the reason you are, I'm an optimist, and doesn't sound like you are about this idea. I have a few months left with colleagues that I have worked with really, really hard on issues like this, and even harder. I am convinced that I can find a member or two or three that might see it in their districts, that might say they have been listening to businesses a little bit too, that we can find common ground. And maybe we won't have to delay it, but maybe we will, because we've got to get it right. I'm optimistic that I will try to work with another member on the other side of the aisle to maybe be able to find that 68th vote. I just want to say that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. So to Representative Frazier's motion to table the bill, a roll call has been called, and we'll take the roll call.
Chair Baker?
No.
Vice Chair Meckland?
No.
Representative Bakeberg?
No.
Representative Berg?
Yes.
Representative Frazier?
Yes.
Representative Greenman?
Yes.
Representative Hussein?
Yes.
Representative Pete Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Wayne Johnson?
No.
Representative Kozlowski?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Schultz?
No.
Representative Zalesnikar?
No.
With 6 for the motion and 7 against, it does not prevail. So back to Representative Baker's, would you like to repeat your motion?
I would, if that's all right, if we're at the right time. Members, again, I really appreciate today's conversation. This went into important times that we need to spend on this issue, and I know this is not the last time we're going to talk about this. We heard a lot of great testimony today from both sides, and I hope we respect the process of what this is. You know, I could go on to different things here, but members, I just want to re-up my motion to please allow House File 11 pass out of the committee on to Ways and Means. That is my motion.
Thank you, Representative Baker. So to that motion, all those in favor?
I'd like a roll call on this.
Representative Frazier has requested a roll call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll now take the roll call.
Chair Baker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Meckland.
Aye.
Representative Bakeberg?
Aye.
Representative Berg?
No.
Representative Frazier?
No.
Representative Greenberg?
Greenman, no.
Oh, sorry. Representative Hussein?
No.
Representative Pete Johnson?
No.
Representative Wayne Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Kozlowski?
No.
Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Schultz?
Aye.
And Representative Zalesnikar?
Aye.
Representative Baker, with 7 ayes and 6 nays, your motion is prevails. And it's on the way to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Members, with that, we are adjourned.